time right out for the Yankees in a
gets through everything. My friend Kraft Ericke, many decades ago, was the one who, as part of a team at General Dynamics, cracked the code and figured out how to make it work. So they've had problems because even though the Space Launch System, which is the rocket, the big 300-plus-foot tall rocket, which is going to launch the Orion spacecraft on a 25-day trip around the moon, even though it's basically updated shuttle technology, and the shuttle technology for decades has been the mainstay of the American space program in terms of fuel, there were problems, and we've had two cancellations for launches. Well, the third time, as they say, is a charm, so we're going to see. The launch now is scheduled, as I said a couple of weeks ago, for 12:07 a.m. November 14th of 2022, in about 2 weeks. We will be on the air because for us, that will be 10:07 p.m. November 13th, which is Sunday night, which is seven tetrahedral minutes after we go on the air. So what I'm planning to do, if the count is, and you know, proceeding normally, if we haven't had a call when they get in the terminal count, which is several minutes before, we're going to go to the Cape Live, and we will carry the launch of America's beginning of its return to the moon, ultimately with human beings, the first woman, the first person of color, decades and decades after the 1972 mission of Apollo 17, we will go there live. Now, many a slip twixt the cup and the lip, so that may not work. Something interesting, however, if you go to item number one, on the other side of midnight, for those of you who are new to the show, what you want to do is go to theothersideofmidnight.com. That will take you to our homepage. And you'll be able to see on that homepage a beautiful banner for tonight, which is very very baseball, something we've never done here before. It basically says the Cosmic World Series of 2022. That's actually kind of an inside pun. Hyperdimensional realities behind the national pastime. Click on that. That will take you to the guest page. And right under the guest page, you will see a line which says fast links to items. Click on my name. That will take you down to my items. Click on number one. This is an update direct from NASA headquarters as to what's going to be happening this week relating to the launch of Artemis 1 next week. This week, Sunday. Yeah, we're in this week. Okay. So the launch is scheduled East Coast time for 12:07 a.m. Eastern. That'll be 10:07 our time. On this Thursday night, actually, let me go to the link and I will read it to you directly. There will be a teleconference at 12 p.m. on Thursday, November 4th, to discuss the status of the Artemis 1 flight test that will be launched by the Space Launch System from the Kennedy Space Center on the 14th. And on the Friday, on the That will be the third. No, that will be the fifth. All right. On Friday the fourth. Sorry, at 12:01 a.m., which is really 10:01 a.m. We're not on the air, so you don't have to worry about that. But at 12:01 a.m. on Friday the fourth, which is one day before our Saturday night show, they're planning to roll the SLS rocket and the Orion spacecraft from the vehicle assembly building 3 miles out the crawler way to the launch pad 39B in the middle of the night. It takes hours and hours and They will not get there until dawn has broken over the Cape. And they actually have, you know, cameras and kind of a live feed, and it's kind of fun to watch how incredibly slowly this thing has to move. Because when you move a several hundred ton stack of crawler and rocket and spacecraft, this is, of course, the biggest rocket that NASA has fielded for a very long time, since the Saturn V. If you roll it too fast, it vibrates. And vibration is not good for spacecraft or begonias or beagles or human beings beyond a certain point. So they move it like at 1 mile an hour, and that's an average. There are places where they slow down. And so it takes, like, you know, from midnight till dawn for it to roll over to the pad. And then, of course, they have to raise it up and they have to jack it down. So the whole thing is going to take all night into the morning. But they have a live set of cameras, and they have a live video feed, not on NASA TV, but on, I believe it's YouTube, to be able to watch all that. And I'm going to make a bold prediction, which we will get into in more detail tomorrow night when we're doing something very, very interesting and kind of pre-Halloween spooky, because Monday night, Monday afternoon, actually, could be Monday morning, but it'd probably be Monday afternoon. There's going to be something very exciting happening in Washington that we're going to talk about tomorrow night, vis-a-vis NASA, UFOs, the Pentagon, what's going bump in the night, all that good stuff. So that takes care of item number one. If you get back to the homepage for The Other Side of Midnight, there is item number two. Item number two is, of course, the stats for the first game of the World Series between the Philadelphia Phillies and the Houston Astros. And just so you understand the context of tonight, why don't I go and read my actual promo that I wrote in the wee hours of this morning, which will give you a kind of a sense of why we're doing all this. Some of you may be wondering why, of all things, I suddenly decided to do a show on baseball tonight. Well, here's part of the answer from Ted Anthony, who writes for the Associated Press. Quote, "Baseball is America's game. The America that was stitching itself together in the first half of the 20th century and becoming a national mass culture. In retrospect, though, at a time when being American was more of a thing than ever before, it ended up being an exercise in candy-coating baseball with myth. Abner Doubleday, Cooperstown, 1839, to prove that baseball was indeed an American game. Like the country at the time, baseball was riding a wave of the emergence of more leisure time among the working class. Like the country of the time, it was transitioning from islands of influence into a truly national mindset, amplified and made immediate by the dawn of a critical new American invention, commercial radio, in 1920. 102 years later, that's tonight, the first game of the World Series opened between two archetypal teams, the Philadelphia Phillies representing the hopes of our founding city, the American origins, and the Houston Astros created to literally represent the American future. Houston, NASA, and the astronauts who took this nation to the moon and are about to again. Two national archetypes representing the fundamental conflicts now swirling around all of us in 2022 between how and why America began and where and how America is going there." Well, that's why we're doing the show tonight. So let me do something interesting here. All right. Let me click, because you can click these days. And let me play something really remarkable from good old Abbott and Costello. Remember Abbott and Costello? They did an hysterical bit. And while we wait for Ron to get to where he can communicate, this is kind of cool. Okay, remember Who's on first, well, if you don't, or if you've never heard it, sit back and prepare for hysterical comedy.
Think about baseball. Now, will you stand still? Pick up your hat. Go pick up your hat.
Okay.
Now, look. Then you'll go and peddle your popcorn and don't interrupt the act anymore?
Yes, sir.
All right. But you know, strange may seem they give ball players nowadays very peculiar names.
Funny names?
Nicknames, pet names.
Not as funny as my name, Sebastian Dinwiddie.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Funnier than that?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Now, on the St. Louis team, we have who's on first, what's on second. I don't know who's on third.
That's what I want to find out. I want you to tell me the names of the fellows on the St. Louis team.
I'm telling you, who's on first, what's on second. I don't know who's on third.
You know the fellows' names?
Yes.
Well, then who's playing first?
Yes.
I mean the fellow's name on first base.
Who?
The fellow playing first base for St. Louis.
Who?
The guy on first base.
Who is on first?
What are you asking me for?
I'm not asking you. I'm telling you. Who is on first?
I'm asking you who's on first.
That's the man's name.
That's whose name?
Yes.
Well, go ahead and tell me.
Who?
The guy on first.
Who?
The first base.
Who is on first?
Have you got a first baseman on first?
Certainly.
Then who's playing first?
Absolutely.
When you pay off the first baseman every month, who gets the money?
Every dollar of it. Why not? The man's entitled to it.
Who is?
Yes.
So who gets it?
Why shouldn't he? Sometimes his wife comes down and collects it.
Whose wife?
Yes. After all, the man earns it.
Who does?
Absolutely.
Well, all I'm trying to find out is what's the guy's name on first base?
No. What is on second base?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who's on first?
That's what I'm trying to find out.
I don't change the players.
I'm not changing nobody.
Take it easy.
What's the guy's name on first base?
What's the guy's name on second base?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who's on first?
I don't know.
He's on third. We're not talking about him.
How did I get on third base?
You mentioned his name.
If I mention a third baseman's name, who did I say is playing third?
No, who's playing first?
Stay off of first, will you?
Well, what do you want me to do?
Now, what's the guy's name on third base?
Well, what's on second?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who's on first?
I don't know.
He's on third.
There I go, back on third again.
Well, I can't change their names.
Will you please stay on third base, Mr. Broadhurst?
Jeez, now, what is it you want to know?
What is the fella's name on third base?
What is the fella's name on second base?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who's on first?
I don't know.
Third base.
Woo! You got an outfield?
Oh, sure.
St. Louis has got a good outfield?
Absolutely.
The left fielder's name.
Why?
I don't know. I just thought I'd ask you.
Well, I just thought I'd tell you.
Then tell me who's playing left field.
Who is playing first?
Stay out of the infield.
So much of their names out here.
I want to know what's the fellow's name in left field.
What is on second?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who is on first?
I don't know. Third base.
Take it easy, man.
Oh, that is so classic. I remember the first time I saw that, I was just a kid, obviously, and part of the fun of that is you get so frustrated because if you're outside, it's kind of like being in multiple dimensions. If you're higher and you're looking down, it's very clear. But if you're in the skit, it's hysterical. So do we have Ron with us? Ron Gerbrun, are you there? Mr. Gerbrun, are you there? No, I think we dropped Ron. We've got Robert Morningstar, who, as I said, actually tried out for the Yankees, and he will tell us that amazing story shortly. We've also got Andrew Curry. Now, you may know Andrew as a illustrator, as an incredible artist, as someone he does storyboards for movies and television and commercials, and he's done several of the Super Bowl incredibly expensive commercials, and they all start out as a story and a set of illustrations, the so-called storyboard. Well, Andrew and I were talking one day, and we were talking about his coaching of his Little League teams in Vancouver. Now, baseball, of course, has incredibly expanded from the 20th century just as an American game. It's now in South America. It's in Central America. It's in the Far East. It's in Japan. I believe there are even teams in China. It's become not just an American game. It's become a world game. And so we were talking about how interacting with kids and teaching them sportsmanship and leadership and all those things that playing a team sport is supposed to inculcate in the next generation. And I said, kind of on a, well, let's see, what was it? It was a leap of faith. I said, what if we did a show? Ron, are you with us yet? I'm not hearing Ron.
Oh.
Okay, I'm still not hearing Ron. Sorry for the technical problems, folks. Skype is wide open.
I'm here.
There you are. Gosh. Communicating with Ron sometimes is more difficult than communicating with the far side of the moon, even if the Chinese didn't put up a satellite to make that really easy. So, Ron, are you with us?
Yeah, I am with you. I was out searching for a signal.
Okay, well, it's still very garbled, so you might have to keep
going. Okay, well...
And no, this is not an Abbott and Costello skit.
Fading in and out, Ron.
Yeah, very much. I'll tell you what, let me, while we're fixing Ron's Skype, Andrew, let me bring you in here. Talk about what got you as a Canadian into this incredible American pastime. And we're going to back up that comment with some information from Ron when we can firm up his communications. Andrew?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Richard. Yeah, so you're right. You did come to me and say, hey, you want to do a show on baseball? And I said, sure. You know, Richard, I'm a bit of a latecomer to baseball. I mean, I played it as a kid just for fun and with my friends and, you know, kind of through school and stuff, but never in a highly organized way. Like, I was a basketball player and a swimmer and then eventually a triathlete and stuff like that. So I like real kinetic sports, things that have time, you know, need a time on it, you know, where you run out of time, et cetera. And baseball just was this sort of strange, mystical, misty thing that, you know, would pass by and I'd play it with my friends. And I remember back in the early 90s when the Toronto Blue Jays won two World Series back to back. And I was walking with a bunch of my friends. We were walking up somewhere near, I don't remember, in the neighborhood. And, you know, we were young teenagers or something. And I remember this gentleman comes by and he says, aren't you guys watching the final game of the World Series with Toronto? I think it was the second time they were about to win. And we all looked at him and said, no. And he started yelling at us, like we as if we had committed some sort of crime. And, you know, Richard, it wasn't until my middle son, when he was 5 years old, started playing Little League. And when he got on the field and he hit his first, like, huge hit, in those days it was called, like, rookie junior, we call it in our league. It's like a, you know, they use a pitching machine, a little slinger, and the kids sort of hammer the ball and they all learn how to fumble around in the field. And
so is this in practice or during, this had to be in practice, right?
Well, it was in the practice, but definitely in the game when he got his first big hit, and he, I think he even scored an inside the park home run in a little mini field, and he lit up. He just lit up, and he told me, "I love this," you know. And then the first thing I thought was, "Oh no!" You know, and the reason why is because I just didn't have an appreciation for the game. But you know, over the last 10 years, and now moving on to 11, I have, you know, become a student, a fan, and just an absolute lover of the game. I fall in love with this game every time I go back out there. Now I'm actually the coaching coordinator of our Mount Seymour Little League. I've sort of ascended to that position, and now I'm going to be the one sort of, you know, training the coaches, or at least getting the right people in place to do that, and, you know, player development. And I love it. I every time I step on the field or every time I come around baseball, I learn something new. And, you know, we'll get into it as the show progresses, but I've had, you know, what I would call some very interesting experiences already just around the little kids game, much less being around the big kids game. And yeah, so that's sort of my introduction, and I love it. I just, it's not only a game, it's not only a sport, and I think it's one of the finest games on earth. I mean, that's my opinion. Just like you said, it's gone international. I mean, let's think about...
Well, do you know that the Toronto Blue Jays are the only international team in a, quote, World Series that have ever won the World Series, ever?
With mostly American players. But yes, you're exactly correct. Yeah,
Which I've always... Right. When I was a kid, I thought to myself, wait a minute. World Series, because back those days it was endlessly, you know, Dodgers and Yankees, Dodgers and Yankees, Brooklyn Dodgers, New York Yankees. It was repetitive. I can't count on both hands how many times in the fall would roll around, you'd hear something on the news about World Series and it'd be Dodgers and Yankees. And I asked myself one day, because there was nobody else who was really into baseball in my family, why do they call it the World Series?
Well, you know, Richard, I want to, you know, later on get into some of the more, controversial. I mean, the sort of maybe esoteric side of baseball that some people think, well, actually a lot of people think and kind of whisper it in the back channels, but you don't get into it, you know, in a big kind of mainstream kind of way. But I wonder if the planners of the game did one day see it being international, because there has been talk of potentially one day. I've heard this. Robert probably knows this too, but like baseball in Japan is huge, right? And they have their Japanese league, and a lot of American players who either are ex MLB guys will go and play out, you know, the last tail end of their
MLB
career, or
Major League Baseball.
Baseball, yeah. Or you'll now start to get these fabulous Japanese players. I mean, we have many, or I mean, MLB has, well, we, I mean, I'm in Canada and we have the Blue Jays. So, you know, there's these fabulous players coming from the Orient now. And it's not just like one or two guys. It's truly becoming international here in North America. And there was talk, and I don't know where the talks went to, of possibly having the winner of the Japanese championship play the winner of the Major League Baseball championship. I remember those conversations. Maybe it was 10 years ago.
That would be so cool.
I know.
And then
but,
you got
yeah,
all the Central American and South American fanaticism
exactly.
about baseball, kind of like what ours was 15, 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Richard, I know you probably want to get a couple of the other guys in here, but I want to say about baseball, and we'll sort of, you know, kind of go around the bases and jump into the outfield and send a few over the fence. Okay, we're going to do lots of puns.
As many punny cliches as we can cram in for the next 4 minutes. Yes, go ahead.
But yeah, Richard, I was going to say, this is one of the most interesting strategic games that I've ever been involved with, just because of the sort of nonlinear time quality of baseball. And it's a game that is, you have to have an incredible amount of patience, and then when all hell breaks loose and chaos ensues, it's the group, it's the guys, it's gals or whoever who can play catch the best who win in the end. So it's an experience. It's not only it's an experience for the players and the managers and the coaches and the trainers, but it's the, you know, the viewers, whether they're watching from TV or they're listening on their, you know, whatever listening device, or they're there live witnessing it. It is.
Well, you realize
incredible.
That Major League Baseball was the reason probably that we got our first Hollywood actor president, Ronald Reagan. Because Ronald Reagan started in radio, and in those days, they basically had a phone line from the radio studio. They didn't do remotes, didn't have the bandwidth, whatever, so they had to do it from the studio so they had the quality, and they would get the scores from the, you know, reporters in the field, literally this case in the field, and many times the phone line would go down, according to the story. And Reagan would duplicate the whole game from a rundown just out of whole cloth. He would make it up like he was narrating it live, and that brought him to national attention, and that brought him to Hollywood, and that brought him to the governorship, and that brought him to the presidency. So without baseball, I can guarantee you that Ronald Reagan would not have become president of the United States.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah,
okay,
I didn't.
We've only got about three minutes to the bottom of the hour. Ron, are you on deck?
Yes, I'm back.
You know, the sound quality is really terrible.
My emergency backup specially stored away headset isn't working, so I'm having to do it the other way. You hear more from the crickets than you're used to.
Okay, I'll tell you what. When we come back, and obviously we're here at the bottom of the hour, when we come back, what I'm going to do is to have Ron go delving deeply into the history of baseball, because it turns out that there is something really amazing that far transcends the Abner Doubleday myths and the idea that this all started just in a place called Cooperstown in 1839. It has an incredibly interesting, long historical and prehistorical antecedent, and our resident generalist, Ron Gervron, has dug it out. You like all these puns? Has dug it out, and we're going to present it when we come back. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and this is that amazing soundtrack from the Robert Redford home run at the end of The Natural.
Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month. 33 cents a day. Support the broadcast that provides you with the most interesting conversation available. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. The other side of midnight.com.
All right, let me hear you good and loud, everyone.
Take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd.
Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jacks. I don't care if I ever get back. Let me root, root, root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame. For it's 1, 2, 3 strikes, you're out at the old ballgame.
And welcome back. Saturday night, October 29th, the Houston Astros and the Philadelphia Phillies are playing the second game of the 2022 World Series tonight in Houston. We don't have a score yet. We don't know who is on first, who's on second, and who's winning. Well, we do know kind of who's winning, but it's not over until, I just have an update from Andrew. I tell you what, why don't I like bring in Andrew? Andrew, why don't you tell everybody live? Go for it.
Yes. Yeah, so the Astros won tonight. Let me see if I can get you a score. I had it here just a second ago. It was 5-2. So 5-2, the Astros won. And tied now, 1-1, best of 7. I think they head back to head to Philadelphia now if it's a 2-2-1-1-1 format, meaning two games.
Well, I think they have a travel day tomorrow, Sunday, and the next game is going to be Monday night, which is the 31st in Philadelphia, Halloween.
Yeah.
And there's a backdrop to the third game of the World Series, the so-called Cosmic World Series, which this is because it is between the Phillies and the Astros. So, Ron, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Excellent. Okay. I want to go back far beyond Abner Doubleday. You've been delving into the real origins of this incredibly international team sport, and you found some very interesting overtones and undertones to things that we've kind of heard about for a long time, but no one has really put them together in the mainstream. So please begin at the beginning.
The beginning was a couple of weeks ago and asking about a show about baseball. And I said, Richard, you know how much you know about sports, which isn't much. But as far as baseball goes, I thought it might be fair to say that it was derived from something called the Mayan ball game. And it's not a very auspicious name for something that's so influential and so ancient. But the archaeologists and anthropologists that deal with this have been arguing about it for years, and nobody's quite sure what they called it. Pock to Pock is one of the names. Pints is another. And neither one of those means something exciting. But the point is that they invented rubber, or discovered rubber, the folks in Mesoamerica. And when the Spanish got here, the most captivating piece of information that I ran across in my research was an account from the two of the Spanish conquistadors, I guess they were, that were looking at these rubber balls, which were everywhere. They were everywhere. Had no trouble cranking them out. They had never seen rubber before. So their idea of something that might bounce a little was an inflated ball. And unless they had much better lungs than we do, it's kind of hard to put 40 pounds of air in a basket with just blowing on it with your mouth. So they had no experience with bouncy things. And the account literally says, and if you drop one of these balls, they bounce, and then it bounces again, and then it bounces again, and it keeps doing that in ever-decreasing arcs.
So it was kind of like a revelation of perpetual motion.
Yeah, and some basic physics, too. I thought that was funny.
Yeah, but they had no idea of physics. But they just saw something that kept bouncing and bouncing and bouncing in the new world amongst a civilization that they looked down on as primitive and bloodthirsty, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. Whereas at every level, except perhaps the bloodletting, and some people argue that, they were far more sophisticated and cosmopolitan than these unwashed strangers from Europe. It was trendy in Europe in the 16th century to think of excessive bathing as unhealthy.
So before we get into the Mayan ball game, which I want to say for a little later, let's go back to Abner Doubleday. How did the damn Doubleday legend, which is absolute fantasy, how did it get started?
You know, I was amazed at how unable I was to find out a proper reason. But I can tell you this. Abner Doubleday was a well-decorated Civil War general. He had terrible hair. Look at the picture of him. Why the hell would anybody look like that? Crazy bit. But aside from that, a council was formed, a commission, an early Robertson panel, and I can't say exactly who. This was 1899, to determine who was going to get credit for inventing baseball. Like the bureaucratic was like setting up to, regularize it and authorize it and oversee it and everything, and they wanted a list of names because people have always played with balls and sticks. I'll get to that in a second. They said Abner Doubleday,
did this. This was after 3 years, by the way. Next time you see a tax form in front of you or a ballot about some tax increase to do something, even in 1899, it took a panel of chosen authorities, and I don't know what that would be, 3 years to decide that, well, let's give it to Abner Doubleday, you know, as if they were giving him a cheese tray.
Abner Doubleday was of the same family as the famous Doubleday Publishing Company, right?
To the best of my knowledge, yes.
So he was a mover and shaker. So was it basically, let's give it to the oligarchs?
That's what it looks like.
Hmm.
That's
so
what it looks like.
So what's the real story?
The real story is that there is a British game that goes back to about the 14th century called Rounders. And it has a diamond-shaped playing field. It's got four bases, although as apparently you can sort of operate from any one as home plate. I mean, I don't know if the pitcher swiveled around or something. I could not find pictures and things of that other than of the ball field. But the differences between it and baseball were significant, but not that many. In other words, you hit a ball with a stick, and then if you had three tries at it, three strikes, and you're out, or you're out when they pitched it. And then when you started running around the bases, you could run around the bases, and I guess they got this from cricket. You could just keep going, you know, so you didn't get to, you could keep going and racking up points running around the, until they were able to hit you with the baseball.
So if you hit it far out, and they had fielders, I presume, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So one of the outfield guys caught it or ran after it, picked it up if he missed it. Then he threw it in toward the center of the field, and another player tried to then pick it up and hit the runner.
Right, not tag, hit. I mean, nail him. You know, they had serious injuries. And
exciting.
Yeah, and there was an equivalent situation with the Mayan game, as far as I can tell. So there were all these echoes back and forth, but there's no evidence that the Mayan game actually caused people to play baseball. They were already playing rounders. There are notes from George Washington during the Revolutionary War about rounders games, and they occasionally called it ball game. Or baseball, the term baseball actually turns up in the mid-18th century. The two were separate, but parallel. And just to jump ahead a tiny bit, in the Mayan story, it's very ritually based, which I know is the part you want to get to later. I assume that's what's literally behind it. Now, whether this is what caused the first person to do it, you know, there's nobody that says that anywhere. Don't know, but it's part of it. And it became actually an important political item. They would literally settle what would be a war by, the champions from each side, playing some pits or Tacapac or whatever.
This is in Central America, in Mayan country.
Yes. Okay. Yes. And actually the Olmecs, if anybody came up with it originally, it was the Olmecs who predated the Mayans by half a millennia.
Hmm.
And
we kicked out Doubleday as the real origin of baseball. Rounders came from England. Do we know the origin of rounders?
No, it's well, it depends. If I read a chronicle of it from Germany, it'll say it started in Germany. If I read one from Italy, it'll say it started in Italy.
Oh,
people like to hit a ball with a stick, you know. So I mean and God knows how many variants there were. And remember, there was also an aggressive point at it where you had to nail the runner with the ball, but Yeah, must have made for some interesting running. I could see them running out of away from the baseline, out of bounds.
So did Doubleday actually kind of reformalize the game and, you know, take out the part where you could run forever and you basically threw a pitch to try to conk the guy and knock him out and that kind of thing? In other words, did the structure of the game that we're familiar with here and now all over the world, did that come from Doubleday or that period in Cooperstown?
Well, you're going to love this answer because I know this is not something I usually quote as a source, but you can even go to Wikipedia, where whoever they cribbed it from says that there's no evidence that he ever even saw a game.
Good grief.
It was purely isolated from the game itself, from anything I can find out. I can be wrong. If somebody calls up and stuff, that's very nice. If I could afford it, I'd buy you dinner, but I couldn't find that missing piece.
Amazing. Okay, let me move to Robert. Robert Morningstar is our resident civilian intelligence expert. He's got a degree in psychiatry, or is it psychology, Robert? I always forget.
Psychology.
But really, the thing that makes him perfect for tonight is he has had this fanaticism growing up in New York about baseball since the Yankees and the Brooklyn Dodgers kept hitting it out every season in the so-called World Series. So, Robert, start with where your obsession began.
Well, I guess growing up in the 1950s, 1957, Mickey Mantle won the Triple Crown. That was most home runs, highest RBIs, and highest batting average. So that sound, I didn't see a game in 1957, but that sound was all over New York City. Mickey Mantle, Mickey Mantle, Mickey Mantle. And over the next few years, I got familiar with it. But my connection to the Yankees began in 1948 when I was in my mother's womb. She came to New York because she had polyps on her throat. So she went to see the top specialist, my uncle Tony, who lived in Brooklyn and was a Brooklyn Dodger fan, took her to the office. And while they're sitting in there waiting to see the doctor, who walks in but Babe Ruth? And my uncle says, "Inez, look, it's Babe Ruth." She says, "Yeah. Who's he?" She said, "You know, he's the greatest baseball player that ever lived." And my uncle, he's saying, "I got to meet Babe Ruth. I got it. I'm going to introduce my niece to Babe Ruth." So he stands up and he says, come with me. And she's 5 months pregnant. And she says, "Mr. Ruth, I'd like to introduce you to my niece, Inez." And he stood up and my mother shook hands with him. And I'm in the womb. And my mother spoke with a Spanish accent. When she told the story, she used to love to tell a story. She said, "He was so big." So, like she was talking
big,
about a red.
Big.
Yeah, big. Like, he was so big.
Like Desi Arnaz. Big. Big. Okay.
Exactly. So I got that touch, you know. It went right through my mom into my womb and then in the womb where I was. So then in 57, 58, 59, Mickey Mantle is hitting hitting home runs that like no one else had ever seen. And I got into it through softball in grammar school. But then in 1960, I got into hardball. And that's all I did for summers, for the next 5 summers. So, of course, 1961 was one of the – I think for me it was the greatest year in baseball because of the Mickey Mantle-Roger Maris home run race. The first time anybody had challenged Babe Ruth's record going for the 60. So these two guys, Mickey Mantle and Roger Maris, start knocking them out. And by April, everybody was calculating, holy mackerel, these guys are on a tear. You know, they could break Babe Ruth's record. So there was a big split here.
Now his record was 60.
Yeah, his record was 60.
Tetrahedral 60. And when did he hit his final home run before the record got broken?
Do you mean Roger Maris?
No. Mantle.
Mantle hit his home run, his last home run, 54,
sometime in August, but he had the misfortune of breaking his foot. So he had to step out of the race at 54, and then Roger Maris plodded on alone. But I want to say something about 1961, and I want to say something about Roger Maris, because his image is burned into my memory, and it has to do with this. I went out to a couple of ball games in 61 when they were at 44, 45. Everybody wanted to see them. So I went with my cousin, who was at Columbia University. And the game opened up, and they announced, ladies and gentlemen, the New York Yankees, and they all ran out. And I knew all the numbers, you know, my favorite players. Of course, I was looking for number 7, Mickey Mantle, number 6, Clete Boyer, number 8, Yogi Berra. He didn't have to run too far because he was the catcher. And then I glanced, and Roger Maris was running out to right field. And that's when I saw the greatness of Roger Maris as what I call the most perfect baseball player I ever saw in my whole life. And it has to do with this. When the Yankees ran out to the field, I was looking at the numbers, and all the numbers were bouncing up and down and going side to side. Now, Roger Maris was in right field, and I was on the third base grandstand looking straight out at him at his back. There was a porch. There was a low concrete porch, about 3 feet high, 4 feet high, in right field. And Roger Maris's number didn't bounce up and down, didn't go sideways. It just got small, like you're watching a railway train moving away on rails. And
or like you're zooming out in a movie.
Yeah, exactly. And I said, wow, look at that. And then I looked at his whole body, and his feet looked like they weren't touching the ground. His feet, his heels never touched the ground. He was running on the toes. And that image is burned into my memory. And it's something that I learned to recognize in great athletes, great performers, and the great Tai Chi master, Cheng Man Cheng, my teacher. The last time I saw him, as he walked away, his feet looked like they didn't touch the ground.
Huh.
Now, yeah, so this is a quality. It's a way to a certain alignment, balance. And when people slip into it, they become super something. Michael Jackson, Fred Astaire, Gene Kelly. And I owe it to Gene Kelly that in 1958 or 59, he did a program for CBS, and he did a program called Sports as Dance. He wanted to encourage people to take dance seriously as an athletic, as a sport, basically. So what he did is he lined up all the greatest athletes of that era, 1959. I remember Bob Cousy in basketball and Arnold Palmer in golf, Mickey Mantle in baseball. And he showed how every one of these athletes was a dancer. And he removed a certain stigma from dance by playing it off with these superstars in sports. And that program made such an impression on me that I'm still talking about it, you know, 64 years later. So Gene Kelly also is one of the greatest athletes of all time. When you see him in the Three Musketeers or the Pirates, you see what an amazing physical specimen he was. And these are all centered human beings. So Roger Maris, we did, Andrew and I did a commemorative in 2021, to the Roger Maris Mickey Mantle home run race. And I got an interview that was done with Roger Maris's teacher. And she was, I'm hearing something in the background. Anyway, it's gone. So Roger Maris's high school teacher said that he was one of the best students she ever had. He was always alert. He loved it. And what she was teaching was geometry. So Roger Maris grew up in Fargo, North Dakota. And in high school, he was a state track and field champion. So what he was working on was perfect body movement. And you can see that in his swing. I love the photograph that I provided there. It says Roger Maris's 61st home run. And if you look at his form practically makes a perfect equilateral triangle.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at his foot
His front foot, he doesn't roll over. His right foot is perfectly planted, and he's swinging around. He also had a very level swing. So when Roger Maris hit home runs, they were line drives. Mickey Mantle had a different style. He would coil up his spine. He'd curl over really tightly. And when he swung his bat, he'd swing the bat with an uppercut, but he'd also straighten up his back. So the ball is getting lift not only from the swing of the bat, but from the stretching up of the spine. So when Mickey Mantle finishes his swing, he's always looking up. And that's how he hit these towering home runs. And I mean, there's something there that says Mickey Mantle's longest home runs. And it started when he was 18 and 19. He was hitting 600-foot home runs, you know, before he got to the major leagues. But in 1955, I believe it is, he hit a ball clear out of Griffith Stadium, which was where the Washington Senators used to play. The Washington Senators or Washington Nationals. He hit it out of the park, across the street, into a parking lot.
Huh.
And it was measured at 565 feet on the fly. Now, the other one, twice he almost hit a baseball out of Yankee Stadium. And there's a photograph there that says Mickey Mantle hits the lights in Yankee Stadium. So one time he hit the facade. It hit the 6 inches below the roof of Yankee Stadium and bounced back. And the physicists got to work instantly. They said it was like a cannon. When he hit the ball, it was like a cannon shot. And the physicists said, this ball was traveling 150 miles an hour, and it could have traveled 736 feet if it hadn't been obstructed.
Hmm.
And then earlier, around 1959, he hit another one that would have left the stadium except that it hit the lights and got bounced back in. So he was legendary. And I have to say, you know, these men they had not only strength, they had might. They were mighty. Mickey Mantle was only 5'11", and weighed 170 pounds in 1957 when he won the Triple Crown. And Roger Maris was 6 feet tall, a little less than 200 pounds. So they had this thing that in Tai Chi we call internal strength. And internal strength comes from being perfectly balanced and perfectly well aligned.
I think we have a recording of the Maris 61st home run with Phil Rizzuto as the announcer, I think.
Yeah.
Is that number four?
I actually sent in two. I wanted to give the audience a sense of that home run race. So I included one home run by Mickey Mantle and then, of course, the 1961. But if Keith doesn't have the Mickey Mantle home run, you can hear the Roger Maris. Folks, this was...
I think we do. It's Mantle hits 565-foot home run. Is that the one?
No. It's a video.
I'd like to play it as an actuality.
Yeah, I think we should give credit to both of them. And then you'll get a sense of what it was like, you know. Mantle 41...
Okay, well, Roger, I don't know where the Mantle one is, so.
It's in the email that I sent to Keith.
Let's go to Maris. Okay, this is Phil Rizzuto, who was a hell of an announcer after being a player for many years. Here's Roger Maris's 61st home run in 1961.
This trick to get gas.
No, we don't want to do that. Gosh, I keep hitting the wrong things.
Yes, standing up. Waiting to see if Maris is going to hit number 61. Here's the windup. Fastball hit deep to right. It's going to be it. Way back there. Oh, how is it?
You know, there's something about a home run and the team and the crowd. It never gets old. Wow.
Well, that has to be one of the most electrifying moments in baseball history. And it's sad to say that, you know, the old timers had a grudge. They had a grudge. Oh, he doesn't deserve, you know, because he played more games, they gave him an asterisk. But it's pointed out that Babe Ruth never had to play a night baseball game. He didn't have to travel cross country, suffer jet lag and all of that. So the New York sports press was a bunch of vipers, you know, and then they harassed him. And they tried to corner him with stupid questions, and Roger Maris was getting fed up. He was just an, you know, I would call country boy, but he was just a regular guy from Fargo, North Dakota. And he comes into the Big Apple, and he's surrounded by millions of people lionizing him. But I remember one question that really drove him mad. You know, he's in the middle of the quest for the 61 home runs. And some stupid reporter says to him, what would you rather do, hit 61 home runs or hit 300? Roger Maris was disgusted with the question.
What?
And he complained about it. The other thing that the press did.
Okay,
is,
we are at the top of the hour, so hold it there. We're talking about Major League Baseball. And speaking of Gene Kelly, together with Frank Sinatra in a remake of Take Me Out to the Ball Game, this is what they did in 1948.
Take me out with the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack. I don't care if I never get back. Let me root, root, root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame. 'Cause it's one, two, three strikes, you're out at the old ball game.
TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. As a Club 19.5 member, you'll gain access to the rest of this show and all previous 350 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Support the broadcast that provides you with the most interesting conversation available. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com.
Katie was baseball mad, had the fever and had it bad, just to root for the hometown through every Sioux. Katie Blue. On a Saturday, her young beau called to see if she'd like to go to see a show, but Miss Kate said no. I'll tell you what you can do. Take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd.
And welcome back on this Saturday night, second game of the 2022 World Series. The Astros won tonight, so it's one for one. And the third game, they skip tomorrow night. Third game, they travel to Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love, and the home of the Phillies, who represent the beginnings of the United States of America from Philadelphia. This is a guy named Edward Meeker from 1908, the heyday of when baseball was becoming the national game. Take a listen.
When the score was just 2-2, Katie knew what to do. Just to cheer up the boys she knew, she made the gang sing this song. Take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack. I don't care if I never get back. Let me root, root, root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame. For it's one, two, three strikes, you're out at the old ball game.
Wow. Andrew, so guys, Is this kind of what it took to get everybody on the same team so it became the national pastime? Like songs and camaraderie and you know, cliches and all those things we keep saying about, you know, three strikes, you're out, that kind of thing.
It achieved ritual status.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, Robert, hang on, I just had a thought. Robert, did you say that Mantle's number was number 60? Oh, I'm sorry, seven?
Number seven.
Number seven. And his record
was
60 home runs. You understand, of course, that those are both incredibly tetrahedral numbers.
Yeah. Well, Mantle's highest number was 54 home runs, but he holds the record for most home runs in the World Series at 18. And probably nobody will ever equal that because nobody gets into the World Series as much as the Yankees did in the 50s and 60s. But I want to say something else. I had a wonderful birthday present. October 18th of 1977, the Yankees were in the World Series, and Reggie Jackson hit three home runs that night. And when Reggie Jackson came to bat the next day, the first at bat, he hit another home run. So he equaled Mickey Mantle's record of four home runs in a row. I'd like to say a little bit something about Babe Ruth, aside from having met him as a baby.
Oh, good. I was going to ask you something about Babe Ruth, Robert.
Do you want to ask me now?
Yeah, what was it? Wasn't one of his pluses a special sort of showmanship? I seem to recall he was the one that would walk up to the plate and he would say, "Okay, I'm going to put it over there," and he'd point up and
he only did that once. Yeah, he only did that once, and it's a legend that he was in the World Series and he had a grudge with the pitcher because the pitcher was really brushing him back and throwing lousy pitches, you know, because nobody wants to be the guy that, for example, everyone dreaded being the guy that gave Roger Maris his 60th or his 61st because they don't want to go into the record books as that guy. So this guy was giving...
well, that's what I call it, giving up a run, because it's like, I win, you lose.
I win, you lose, but my loser will go into the record books as the pitcher of record. And I have to give credit to Bill Fisher and Pedro Ramos. They're the Pedro Ramos pitched the ball that Mickey Mantle almost hit out of Yankee Stadium, and Bill Fisher, they call him now, but Jack Fisher, was the guy that gave up the 61st home run to Roger Maris. But be that as it may, in answer to Ron's question, he came up. And he pointed to center field, and he said, "I'm going to put it over there." And on the next swing of the bat, he did so. It's become a legendary story. But Babe Ruth, I live six blocks away from where Babe Ruth lived. Babe Ruth was married in the chapel or the church of my grammar school, St. Gregory the Great. And Babe Ruth used to race to Yankee Stadium when there was no West Side Highway in those days. And Riverside Drive was the fastest way to get there. So he'd be late, and he would roar up Riverside Drive. And the cops would catch him for speeding. And when they went up to him, he'd say, "Hey, I'm Babe Ruth. I'm on the way to the Yankee Stadium. I'm late for the game." The cops would call for two more squad cars and sirens all the way up to 145th Street and cut across 145th Street to get him to Yankee Stadium on time. And earlier this afternoon, I was telling you about how hot it is in Yankee Stadium in the summertime with the sun beating down on you. And the stadium, three-quarters of it blocks the wind. So if the wind isn't coming from center field in, you know, you're in a pit, in an oven. So what did they do before air conditioning? The Babe Ruth and the Yankees would have a big, big tub of ice, and Babe Ruth would put a big head of lettuce or a cabbage in there, and then when it was time for him to go out to the outfield, he'd scoop up the lettuce or the cabbage and pack it in his hat and wear it under his hat to keep his head cool.
Oh,
while he's,
my God.
Yeah. Babe Ruth is quite a story. He was... he was raised in an orphanage. I think it was called St. Mary's Orphanage, a Catholic orphanage down in Baltimore. And then he became the super pitcher for the Boston Red Sox. And the curse of the Red Sox is that they sold Babe Ruth to the Yankees as a pitcher. And the people in Boston believe that God put a curse on them for selling Babe Ruth.
Oh, that's where the Red Sox curse came from.
The curse of the Red Sox. But they sold Babe Ruth when he was a pitcher to the Yankees, and as soon as he got to the Yankees, they said, no, you're going to be an outfielder because you can really hit a baseball. And, of course, there's Lou Gehrig, the wonderful biography with Gary Cooper. I can't watch it because it still brings tears to my eyes. It's a real tearjerker, and his story is tragic.
Well, he had ALS, and it was horrible.
Yeah, he had ALS, and it caught him at, a high point of his career. And he had, 2,176 straight games at first base, and then it forced him out. And I also had the privilege of watching Cal Ripken break that record. You know, remember that? Cal Ripken?
I know the name.
He was a Baltimore Oriole third baseman.
Right. I'll tell you what, we have a clip here, I think, from Babe Ruth, so let's play it and see what it sounds like, okay?
Yeah, sure.
Let me do this, and this, and then I can do that, and then we can do this.
America's greatest sports hero. His awesome home run wallops revolutionized the game. He hit 714 in his lifetime, a record no player has ever threatened. His longest home run traveled 587 feet, almost the length of two football fields. Ruth's fame spread across the nation and even overseas to the streets of Japan. Wherever he traveled, the people greeted the home run king as a hero. This one man with his mighty muscles, quick reflexes, and keen eyes accomplished seemingly fantastic feats. He towered above the multitude. Everything the Babe did was new. From breaking records to exercising with a medicine ball. The Yankee slugger had only to appear in a children's hospital ward, and the room was bathed in smiles. He autographed baseballs by the thousands and gave wide-eyed youngsters tips on how to hit a home run ball. Yes, Babe Ruth became a legend. 12 years he led the league in homers. 4 times he hit 54 or more in a season. And over the span of his career, the Babe broke or equaled 54 Major League batting records. Baseball fans flocked to the ballparks in unprecedented numbers to watch the Babe perform his prodigious feats, even in special exhibitions. They might be fans of the team, but they were also fans of his one-man show. So great was Ruth's magnetism for attracting paying customers that Yankee Stadium became known as the house that Ruth built. They came to watch the Babe for 22 years until he played his final game in 1935. Years later, sad or by, they returned once more for a farewell tribute to the man who came out of a Baltimore orphanage to become a national idol. His once mighty frame now wasted away, the Babe walked out to the scene of his many triumphs, and once again he brought down the house. Ruth started playing professional baseball for $600 a year. At his peak, he earned $80,000. Following his exploits, there were bigger salaries for sluggers who could hit home runs and bigger profits for the owners who hired them. The New York Ball Club acknowledged its debt to the Babe by retiring his famous number for all time. No other Yankee would ever again wear Ruth number 3. Honored by Baseball's Hall of Fame.
Okay, that is really interesting. Again, the symbolic line through Babe Ruth's number 3, another tetrahedral number. Interesting.
Richard, can I
comment about
the number?
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, the number 7 you guys were talking about, that's a really interesting number, you know, because when we look at when a batter goes through his or her ordeal, a full count is 3 balls, 2 strikes, but if you can only get if you strike out, you have 3 strikes and you would have 3 balls. And if you get a walk, you get four balls and 2 strikes. But there are 4 balls and 3 strikes, and that's 7. If you actually add it all together, it's 7. And that's a real, like you said, it's a significant number, right? And there's so many ancient references to that, right? I mean, I wrote down some notes here. Geometry, grammar, rhetoric, logic, arithmetic, music, and astronomy are considered the 7 noble of the liberal arts. In ancient Egypt, 7 represented completion. There are seven colors in the rainbow. There are seven notes in a musical scale, and they're in 7 days a week. Seven is said to be a perfect number because it contains both three and four, the triangle and the square, which we see on the field in baseball. And it goes back to what Ron was saying, is that we're seeing ritual playing out. We are, you know, some sort of codified ceremony is happening when these games are being played. At least I'm more and more convinced of this because of the feelings I've had just being, you know, like a little league coach and some of the stuff.
Well,
I've
look at
through,
the
so.
Incredible archetypal background to the World Series, you know, second
exactly.
game tonight, third one Monday night. You've got the Phillies representing the ideals, the hopes, the you know, ever becoming more perfect union, the whole idea of what this experiment, the American experiment, was supposed to be. And then you've got the Astros, which is relatively recent. It was named literally after the fact that NASA put the manned spacecraft center in Houston, Texas, because of Johnson's deals. And it represented the astronauts, the future, going to the moon and beyond. And then in the most bizarre, you know, kind of play out of reality overwhelming the symbolism, I mean, the Astros are probably the most hated main MLB team you can imagine, because we found out, you know, a few years ago that they cheated with secret
yes.
signals on the yeah. field, on live television for 10 effing years, and they just got a slap on the wrist. So the the way that NASA has gone wrong by keeping all the good stuff that we need desperately to save civilization secret, the Astros tonight and in the next few days represent the badness of NASA, and the Phillies represent the hopes and dreams and the future aspirations of this fledgling experiment called America.
And, yeah. and Robert, before you go in, I want to add to that. Yes. So it was the Astros who the Philadelphia beat in the last game of the season to make the playoffs as a wild card, which is incredibly rare. I don't know when the last time it was done. And Philadelphia, I think, only won about 87 games in the regular season compared to the Astros, who were over 100 games that they won. And so it's like David versus Goliath.
David and Goliath, yeah. So, Robert,
well,
go ahead.
What I was going to say, you know, cheating and corruption is part of the, is part of the baseball history. You know the saying, say it ain't so, Joe? That goes back to the 1919s Black Sox scandal. The Black Sox instead of the White Sox, because they were betting on their own games to make extra money. And that was a huge scandal, and practically the whole team was blackballed, blacklisted, and in great shame. And then there is Pete Rose. You know, I think that guy's a bum. He should have been in the Hall of Fame, but he's not going to be in there because of his cheating. I saw Pete Rose.
Well, when you say cheating, you mean he bet on baseball.
He bet on his own game. He threw games so he could win the bet. And I saw him do it. I was visiting my girlfriend's family in 1984 or 85 in Michigan. And my girlfriend's father said, I'm going to take you to a Chicago baseball game. And it was in Wrigley Field, you know, the one that had no lights, and the Chicago Cubs. And I'm watching Pete Rose play third base, and the game is close. There's a stupid little grounder that any high school kid can handle. I see Pete Rose run awkwardly with his legs apart. It looked strange to me. And Richard, he jumped on his nose. He pretended to fall. He took a dive. He landed on his nose, and the ball got by him, and they lost the game. And I looked at that and said, you know, I had a moment of cognitive dissonance. Like, there's something wrong with that. And a couple of years later, he was exposed as a big fraud. But the Astros cheating was like NASA. It was high-tech cheating.
Yes. Well, for people who don't know baseball, and there are people out there who do not follow baseball, describe why what the Astros did was so down and dirty.
Well, they set up a Zoom camera in dead center field, so they could zoom in on the catcher and televise the signal through closed circuit into the dugout. And they had they could read the digits, you know, fastball, three fingers, two fingers, change up. And they could read it through the television camera. And then they had certain signals for the players when they went up to the plate. They either banged on a can or slammed against the dugout, and all of these secret signals to tip off the next player that what pitch was coming. And so they did very well with that for a couple of years. But when they were found out, heads rolled, and the disgrace was incredible. You know, their general manager was axed. The field manager was axed. One of the players who got a job as a coach for the New York Mets, he got axed. So it's a very big price to pay for cheating, because America doesn't like cheaters. So that's
But Robert, this is so, you know, baseball is the metaphor for life. Like I said on the top of the show, you know, everything's peaceful. We're all going along, go see a movie, go to the park, do our Tai Chi, do a radio show. And then all hell breaks loose. A stampede happens. People get hurt or killed. All kinds of things just suddenly happen. It's how we react. Gambling has been like a handshake with baseball since the beginning. That's why we have box scores. That's why we follow all the numbers of the players. I mean, this has been inherently part of it. Just like, I think, Richard, in your promo, you talked about radio. Because remember, TV wasn't, you know, like when Maris was playing, I think black and white was starting to come out, Robert, black and white TV. But it was really
color.
A radio. Color was coming up. Yeah,
color was coming up.
But it was radio. So it's all of these technologies are going along. And gambling, I mean, think about it. We're always trying to cheat.
It was
death,
always
right?
outside. It was always. I was. The gambling was always outside the stadium. You know, it was. You know, the mafia and bookies and all of that, and local people making bets. But this brought it into the baseball, and it sullied the game. And so I can tell you, I can never forget freaking Pete Rose jumping on his nose. And he came up with a real – he really did jump on his nose. I could see from the stands that it was kind of red and ruddy and almost bleeding. And he
so
did that.
So, in, you know, we're an evening of cliches, he literally took a dive.
He took a dive, yeah, indeed.
But again, guys, I think this idea
a
of
a nose dive.
Yeah,
very good, Ron.
No, but it's this idea of trying to cheat the game of life, right? Like baseball is so indicative of trying to find perfection. I'm telling you, every time I step on, just as a little kid coach, I'm like, oh my gosh, there are these waves or these epidermal layers that you've got to get through into the game beyond understanding strategy and all the basic, you know, like basic plays and all the different things that go on, all the different skills. There are subtleties at work in the game all around it. And everybody's trying to usurp that, you know, do that in life, do that in the baseball game. I think it's such a beautiful parallel. It really is.
Now,
Rob,
Richard,
you make them sound so noble, Andrew.
Yeah. Well, they are.
With a muffin top above their belt and grass stains all over their uniforms, and they spend a lot of time scratching their jock strap. Sounds like a bunch of noble people.
You can tell he's not a fan. You can tell he's not a fan.
They risk their lives in baseball. Tony Conigliaro lost an eye. Mickey Cochran, for whom Mickey Mantle is named by his father, he took a baseball in the head, and he was in a hospital for 7 days, and that's when the calls for protective equipment came. So it's not all roses. It's a very dangerous.
Robert, the point I'm actually making is that there will be somebody, and it won't be a scant number that will cheat in any circumstance where there's variables.
Yes.
And
But
yeah, so they're not all the knights of the diamond shaped table. You know?
Yeah, but we don't measure life by the worst of us; we measure it by the best of us. Aspiration,
yeah.
And most of baseball, as far as I know, has been pretty clean up until this bizarre steroid nonsense, where people who should never be allowed near the Hall of Fame, like Barry Bonds, and there's a couple others. They literally took the
Mark McGwire
game away from Roger Maris, and an honest, clean, upstanding young guy did not get it back on the mainstream of baseball until Aaron Judge just a few days ago. Talk about that.
Right.
Talk about that.
Amen.
Right. But I wanted to comment. Richard earlier in the program talked about what made what made baseball America's an archetypal American sport, and he mentioned two things. He mentioned camaraderie and teamwork, and that really is the essence of American success. When people like each other, support each other, work as a team, that's when we succeed. And when we are divided and egotistical. Because that's the thing about baseball. No one man can win the game. It's really a team sport, and everyone has to pull together to do their best and support their team players. So that's a unique quality that baseball possesses. And I believe it's really what made America super great through the 30s and the 40s and World War II. By the time World War II rolled around, baseball camaraderie and teamwork was imbued in every real American, and that spilled over into the armed forces. So I think it's something that America has to cultivate and recapture. I was saying to Richard that this is the first year, because of the politicization of baseball over the last 3 years and the kneeling of the national anthem, I was disgusted. I didn't watch a game for 3 years. But then this year, I turned the channel, and there were the Mariners playing the Astros, and I saw the fervor and the joy of the crowd and everybody huddled together and no masks and yelling their brains out and just having a wonderful time, and it restored my faith in baseball as the great unifier of our society. So I started to follow it again, and I sat through the ALS championship and the ignominious loss to the dastardly Astros by the New York Yankees.
But then we wouldn't be set
there
up.
There was no joy in Mudville.
We wouldn't then, if they hadn't lost, we wouldn't have this archetypal, the origin of the country against the degraded future of the country represented by the Astros, and the decision point coming really just in a couple of weeks. That's a symbology here. When I was talking to Andrew about doing this, I thought, well, let's wait till the World Series. I had no idea how archetypal this World Series was going to be. Let me read you something again, and then I want to make a commentary. This is from Ted Anthony's AP kind of rundown on why baseball. Like the country of the time, baseball was riding a wave of the emergence of more leisure time among the working class. He's talking about the early teens, that clip I played from 1908, et cetera. And then he says, like the country of the time, it was transitioning from islands of influence, meaning local teams, local, turnout, local fans, into a truly national mindset, amplified by critical American invention, which was radio. But what he doesn't say in that first part of the paragraph is that all that new leisure time the working class had to go to games, it was because of this incredible wave of American ingenuity and invention, and people like Edison and, one of my guests has talked about all of the amazing inventions that spread out from this continent all over the world that stemmed basically from the creation and establishment of the Washington Monument. So if we're looking at hyperdimensional influences, we kind of have to look at that and ask ourselves, is the reason that baseball really became so universal because it started in a place that had the cultural context and the technological prowess to create all that free time for the middle class, the working class, to go to a game and root for a team?
Well, the Washington Monument can be looked upon as kind of a four-edged bat standing on its
Well,
end.
David Sirita has done this incredible work, and I'm telling you, that monument had a pivotal effect in the hyperdimensional model on the outcome of the country, not the least of which was the technologies that gave the working class leisure time, and then the one invention, radio. Tesla, yeah. Radio, not Marconi, yeah. Tesla, radio in the 20s.
You know, the Washington Monument is not complete. It's not complete. It's supposed to have a circular Stonehenge around it.
I saw that as one of the original plans.
Yeah, the original plan. And just coincidentally, in 1999, the chief druid of England, whom I had visited in England many times and gone to Stonehenge, he came to New York. And where did I take him? Yankee Stadium. And he didn't understand baseball. And when he saw it, he said, oh, this game is much more strategic than I ever imagined. You don't get that. Because he saw somebody stealing a base, and I explained to him, you know, a guy sacrifices himself, you know, like a sacrifice bunt to advance the runner. I explained. He said, and he went away with a deeper appreciation of baseball as not just hitting a ball and running.
Well, you keep finding these threads, and actually we don't have time to go into them right now because we're at the bottom of the hour. However, when we come back, what we're going to do is pick up exactly what we are talking about now. My guests this morning are baseball fans, except for Ron, Andrew Curry.
Oh, I don't hate it. I'm just ignorant.
Andrew Curry, Ron Gerbrun. Well, I'm not a real obsessive fan either, but I do know a little things. And what I'm watching tonight, and we'll get into more of it later in the program, the symbolic threads that knit the game together with a higher level, hyperdimensional, symbolic reality. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return.
The other side of midnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Support the broadcast and don't miss another groundbreaking conversation. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. The other side of midnight.com.
Welcome back, everyone, on this Saturday night. Sunday morning is coming up here in about the next half hour. It is the night of the second game of the World Series of 2022, the Cosmic World Series, as I've dubbed it, between the Houston Astros, the team you love to hate, the team that was patterned for a future of America after NASA going to the moon and all that, and then did the extraordinarily horrible, desperately money-driven, money-grubbing thing of setting up a systematic way to cheat by sending on closed-circuit television to the dugout the signals from the catcher of what the batter was going to confront when the pitcher fired one over the plate. And then, of course, we have this whole thing about the drug problem. How did we get off the rails, guys, in the 1990s with Barry Bonds and McGuire and take it away from the guys who did it by sweat and muscles and training and healthy food?
I think it's greed. I think personally it was greed. You know, the desire to break records and the ease, you know, the facility of accessing steroids and just pumping yourself up. But in all fairness, I'd like to say to all my friends in Texas, I think the Astros paid a high price and that they redeemed themselves, and this team is clean. And I wish them luck. And I wish the Phillies luck. And I watch these games with detachment since the Yankees aren't in there. but you know, can I go back for a moment? Because this is a wonderful, Richard, I have to tell you, this is a wonderful experience to be talking about baseball and not all the doom and gloom and terrible things that we've been discussing over the last few years. But it's really kind of purification.
Yeah.
To be able to discuss these things. So I don't want to go back to yesteryear, and I would be remiss, at least to my fellow New Yorkers, not to talk about the Dodgers and the Giants and the really greats like Willie Mays. The Willie Mays super catch of the 1954 World Series, where he was, by the way, that was done in the Polo Grounds. The Yankee Stadium had the deepest center field in all of baseball except for the Polo Grounds. Yankee Stadium was 461 feet deep in center field, but the Polo Grounds was 481 feet deep. And in the 54 World Series, the opposing players hit a towering drive, and Willie Mays took off like a gazelle, and he ran, and with his back to home plate, the ball was coming over his head, and he did what is called the over-the-shoulder catch, but it was really over-his-head catch. He backbent. He bent his back all the way back so he could pick up the ball, and he basket caught it right in front of himself. And it's one of the greatest feats in baseball ever, and it's something that I practiced. Once you see it, you know, and you know it can be done, it opens up avenues. Once the impossible becomes possible, it's possible for everybody. So we owe that to Willie Mays. And the Brooklyn Dodgers, you know, they were the Brooklyn Bums because they were in the World Series so many times and the Yankees kicked their butts until 1956. And even though Don Larson threw a perfect game, the Brooklyn Dodgers won the World Series and then the skullduggery began. And in the offseason, Walter O'Malley, talk about hated people. Walter O'Malley couldn't show his face in the car for 10 years because he sold the Dodgers to Los Angeles. And all these players that, I mean, Brooklyn was even crazier than the Bronx for the Yankees. Brooklyn lived and died with the Dodgers. And when he sold the Dodgers to Los Angeles, or sold out to Los Angeles, oh, man, he couldn't show his face in New York. He would have been strung up. And we had 5 years without a National League baseball team in New York until the amazing Mets came in 1961.
You know, hey, Robert?
Yeah.
You haven't mentioned where the Dodgers or what the Dodgers' original name was as a team. You know that, right?
No, but tell me. I'll tell you why they are called the Dodgers. But tell
no,
me.
They were the Brooklyn Trolley Dodgers.
Well,
because they had to cross, they had to cross a rail yard to get to the field.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to say. The people to get to the field had to dodge trolleys, and that's how they got their name. But I didn't know that the actual team was called Trolley Dodgers.
Wow.
Yeah, the original name of the team actually was the Trolley Dodgers.
Yeah, yeah.
According to what I saw or read.
Yeah, it's a problem. It's absolutely true. Willie Mays, fantastic. Superstar. If you want, you know, you can go on YouTube and see a home run derby between Mickey Mantle and Willie Mays. It's a pretty interesting. That was a TV show, half an hour long, and they'd get the two best home run hitters of the week or the season, and they pit them off against each other. And if they hit a home run, they'd get $500, and they'd get $1,000 if they won the whole thing. So they go at it. I won't tell you who won, just not to be a spoiler. The most graceful pitcher that I've ever seen in my life was Sandy Koufax. When he threw a curveball, man, that they felt like literally, as they used to say, it looked like it rolled off the table. And I want to tell, I mentioned this to Richard earlier today, why a baseball breaks more for a left-handed pitcher than for a right-handed pitcher. And I went over this today. I have my baseball here. The stitching on the baseball is shaped like an arrowhead. And when the right-hander throws the ball, the spin on the ball, the arrowhead is cutting the air like an arrowhead. But when a left-hander throws the ball, the pitch, the rotation is reversed, and the tail feathers of the arrow are cutting the air, so there's more air resistance, and that's why the breaking ball from the left breaks more. It's pure aerodynamics.
Now, do you have there's a baseball there in your den?
Yeah, I do. Sure, I have two baseball. I have a Roger Maris 1961 baseball bat, and there's a mini one in British Columbia, because last year when Andrew became the coach, I got psyched up and I became an assistant coach via Skype. So I was sending these videos that some
it's
of which today, and I was coaching his kid via Skype, and I got a little league Roger Maris baseball bat that I mailed out to Stellan. But you know what, man, UPS is a ripoff. I went in and hey, I'd like to send this to British Columbia, and how much would it cost? 7 ounces, the baseball bat. And the guy says, $228.
What?
What exactly?
Oh, wow.
What?
That's nuts.
So finally, I was able to get it over there for $57 or $54.
Well, can't you express mail it for like $25, $30?
No, those days are gone, Richard. We're living in the 1970s with those prices. But anyway, I thought it was outrageous. But we got it there, and I got one for myself. And I have two baseball gloves and the baseball's here.
Okay, the reason I wanted to know, pick up the baseball and look at it, okay?
Yeah.
What's the obvious thing you see on a baseball?
The yin and yang sign.
That's one of them, but what's the other? What are they made of?
Oh, the horsehide.
The stitching.
Right.
The red yarn.
Yeah, I had a friend who was deeply into this named Nick. He did not mm-hmm. want to come on the show tonight. He's scared to death of radio and audiences and all that, but he's incredibly interesting as a scholar. He wrote to me this afternoon. He said, do you realize that there are, wait for it, 108 stitches on a baseball? And he said, do you know what that means? And of course I said, oh, of course, because it's another hyperdimensional equation number. 108 is 1080, which is one half the diameter of the moon. It relates to the design of the solar system. It relates to hyperdimensional physics. It's part of the precessional cycle. How did 108 stitches wind up on the ball, the centerpiece of the national pastime?
And what's inside it? A super string.
I'm sorry I didn't include the picture. I had a breakaway, couple of breakaway pictures of a baseball, and I said, nah, nobody's going to care about that part. But yeah, they've got cork in the middle.
It's got a cork in the middle, and it's wrapped with a super string.
Yeah.
It just wound up at the super speeds. So it's a real cosmic object. And since I mentioned the Tai Chi sign, I want to tell people that, you know, when you see the Tai Chi sign, the yin and yang on a piece of paper, it's not flat and it's not dualistic. The yin yang is really hyperdimensional. So,
well, you know the biggest example of the yin yang in our reality, don't you?
Tell me.
The moon of Saturn, Iapetus.
Oh, yes.
The black and the white side are formed cosmically. And we now know kind of how they're formed, but they, for decades before the first photos from Voyager, you know, this moon would wink. It would disappear on one side of Saturn and then reappear. And that's because as the moon goes around Saturn, its one face is towards Saturn. So we saw the dark half, which is almost pitch black carbon material. And then the white half, which is basically ice, bright white ice, and the separation. When we got the first Voyager image back in 1980, yin-yang, a perfect cosmic yin-yang in the solar system.
That's beautiful. I'd like to go back to the Amazing Mets. And the reason they're called the Amazings is in the first two seasons, they found every possible way to lose a game.
Talk about the origin of the Mets and the fact that after the Dodgers left, the trolley Dodgers went to L.A.,
yeah.
You know, New York had one team, and then somewhere, somehow, someone put together the idea of a second, major league team.
Yeah, yeah.
How did the Mets How do the Mets come about?
Well, that's because the Giants went to San Francisco. California stole our two National League teams. So one went to Los Angeles, the other went to San Francisco. But this gentleman named William Shea got the idea that he had to lobby to get a national team, National League team back in New York. And as a result of his lobbying, there was a slight expansion of the National League to accommodate that. So it took him from 1956 to...
Okay, for people that don't know, talk about the Baseball Commission, talk about the American League, the National League, who makes up the league, et cetera.
Well, it's bifurcated. The National League and the American League were rivals forever, and the business interests really dictate a lot of their policies. So,
well, it's the owners, isn't it?
Yeah, the owners are the members of the National League and the American League boards of directors. So, you know, I think the Yankees were very happy with having a monopoly here in New York, exclusive. You don't like it? Lump it, right? Well, William Shea was able to lobby, and he was able to get the franchise. He was able to get the National League to agree to an expansion of teams that allowed the Mets to appear in New York. I have to say there was a guy named Marvelous Marv Thronberry. This guy was a fantastic hitter, but if there was any way to drop a ball, any way to make an error, that guy would hit a home run in the eighth inning to put everybody ahead, and then in the ninth inning, he'd make some egregious error, hence his name, a Marvelous Marv Thornberry. But I owe it to the Mets because they brought back into baseball super great Dodgers like Duke Snider and Gil Hodges. So I got to see, you know, these guys who were superstars from the 1950s who came back, and they were still great. And they played in the Polo Grounds, so I got to see a game in the Polo Grounds. That's how I know about the dimensions of
when,
that
when state. Did the Mets play their first game in New York?
It was 1960. Yeah.
And the Mets are obviously short for Metropolitan.
The Metropolitans, yes, the New York Mets. And then they were the laughingstock of baseball. They lost more games than any other team in the history of baseball. And then we had a team called the New York Jets, which was a new football franchise. But 1969 was the glory year. You know, just like Babe Ruth pointed to center field and said, I'm going to put it there. Joe Namath came out and said, we're going to win the Super Bowl. And nobody took him seriously. But that year, the Mets won the World Series. And the Jets won the Super Bowl. So again, that's
well. Let me tell you my own personal baseball story, and it involves the Mets because I never really followed obsessively, you know, because it got boring. Yankees, Dodgers, and the Yankees always won. And it's like if one team is always going to win, you kind of lose interest, you know. And
yeah.
As a kid, you know, in those formative 50s, you know, I just it's going to be the Yankees. Who cares? That kind of thing. So
yeah.
I kind of drifted away. I'm out in Los Angeles. I'm covering for Cronkite and CBS the first landing on the moon. We move from North American Rockwell up to JPL. I wind up on the air, you know, narrating for Mars. Had to borrow a sports jacket because I didn't have any clothes to wear on the air. The producer suddenly said, okay, Hoagland, you've been at me for years now to get on the air. You're on the air. And it was the morning show, and I had nothing literally, we're on television. So, you know, I'm covering the Apollo 11 landing on the moon from Los Angeles. I fly back to New England. I'm living in Hampton, Connecticut, which is just below Springfield then. And what I would do is I would drive into New York to the Bureau or to do other stuff and whatever. And I'm literally on a wonderful fall afternoon. We've landed on the moon. It's an amazing year. I'm working for the man, the most trusted man in America, Walter Cronkite, as his science advisor. And I'm driving in and I've got the radio on. And I'm listening kind of with half an ear to the game. And suddenly, in the year we land on the moon, the team that couldn't shoot straight, pitch straight, do anything straight, they win the damn World Series. It was phenomenal. It was like an omen. writ large.
Yeah. Well, you know, again, back to the Mets and their struggles. I want to talk a little bit about St. Louis and St. Louis Cardinals. One day, I think it's around 1967, you know, I've become a Met fan because my grammar school girlfriend just loved the Mets, and she was not a Yankee. Oh, I guess I'll watch the Mets. So I latch on to them. So I'm watching this game, and it's St. Louis versus the New York Mets, and it's just goose eggs and goose eggs and goose eggs for the Mets. And in the eighth inning, I said, oh, man, this sucks. I changed the channel. And then I turned it on again later, and it says, Bob Gibson pitched a perfect game against the New York Mets today. So I saw a perfect game up to eight innings, but I got so frustrated. I didn't realize it was happening because, of course, there's that it's taboo to mention that a guy is pitching a perfect game because you jinx him if you say it.
During the game.
Yeah, during the game. So none of the...
Okay, for people that are not baseball fanatics, what's a perfect game?
Perfect game is where nobody reaches first base.
So every single pitch across the plate is no hits, it's an out, okay?
No hits, all outs. Or
catches in the field.
Strikes, yeah. You could fly out, ground out, or be struck out. And so 27 players come to the plate, and not one of them touches first base. That's a perfect game. And Don Larson did that in the 1956 World Series. It's a very famous scene. And it was right around this time. You know, it's October. October is World Series time. That's why they call Reggie Jackson Mr. October, but it really belongs to Mickey Mantle. Well, you know, if I have a couple of minutes to talk about my tryouts for the New York
Yankees.
Well,
I wanted to save that for the top of the hour.
Okay, sure.
I want to give you enough runway to do it properly, given that you're the only one here who tried out for a major league team. Literally in Yankee Stadium?
Yeah, I tried out in Florida and Fort Lauderdale and then in Yankee Stadium.
Wow, okay, well hold that because I want to go to something else. When the game of rounders was reorganized, however that happened, and apparently according to Ron's excellent research, Doubleday had nothing to do with it, how did he wind up as the guy we're all talking about? Anyway, you no longer, you know, pitch the ball to hit the guy and try to knock him out and knock him down and all that. Something emerged in baseball called stealing a base. Now, if my memory serves correctly, it was Willie Mays who still holds the record for bases stolen during a game. Am I right or wrong?
You're wrong.
Okay.
The one I remember is Maury Wills of the Los Angeles Dodgers. He broke that record. He was a swift, wiry little baseball player, and
talk about what stealing a base entails, because it sounds much more gruesome than it actually is.
Well, it could get gruesome at second base when the throw comes in. Well, basically, is when you're off in first base, or you can actually steal third base, and that's really ballsy. But you're on first base, and you get the timing on the pitcher, or if the pitcher's a little sluggish or unaware, you can just tear for second base and try to slide in and steal it. And there's also the liability that in order to steal the base, you have to take a long lead off first base and you can get picked off. Now, the left-handers, there's some left-handers who could look at the plate and throw the ball at a right angle. You know, the right-hander has to swivel around and throw the ball.
You're talking about the pitcher now.
The pitcher, yeah, the pitcher. As a right-hander, if he sees a guy that's leaning off the base and wants to steal the base, the right-hander has to swivel his body, turn toward first base to throw the ball. But there were some pitchers, left-handed pitchers, who could stay facing home plate, take the ball, and just right-angle hit the first base and pick off players. Sandy Koufax was one of those guys. He had an incredible pickoff move. But if you don't pick him off, the guy gets he takes a long lead, and he gets a jump on you, and he tries to steal first base. But if the ball gets to second base before the runner gets there, he's either out by sliding in, or sometimes they change their mind, and then you have a real comedy. be tracking them down because they have to close. The guys throw
it's almost like a tennis match, back, forth,
tennis match over the head of the running player because you don't want to hit them, you know? So that's always pretty comical. There's another thing that's really rare, and I've seen it three times in my life, and it's a one-man triple play where one guy starts running, let's say first and second base, and one guy starts running on the hit, both runners start running. The shortstop or the second baseman will catch it on the fly. He's out, steps on the base. The other guy is out, and he tags the other player. He was trying to get back. One-man triple play. It's every 7 years or every 10 years it happens, but I was able to see it. I've been around a long time. Every 7 years, and I saw three single-man triple plays in my lifetime.
So what are the list of records that Major League Baseball actually offers? You got home runs, number of hits in a season. Kind of go down the list of the records.
Runs batted in, home runs, highest batting average. They have something called slugging average.
What's that?
Slugging average is an average of how many times you go up to the plate and get more than a single or hit home runs. It's a very esoteric record, calculating the extra base hits that a player gets and how many times at bat. So let's see what else. Consecutive games, no hitters, consecutive strikeouts. So I'm more familiar with the batting records, but you know, I would be remiss if I didn't mention Whitey Ford, because in that era, the Mantle, Maris, Yogi
Another
Berra,
name of history.
Yeah, Whitey Ford. He was a you know, by our standards now, he was a diminutive sized pitcher, but he had such grace and he had such amazing control that he was a left-hander for the New York Yankees, and he held many World Series records. Again, because the Yankees twice won five World Series in a row, or won the pennant five times in a row. And there was heartbreak. In 1960, in 1960, the Yankees scored more runs in the World Series than any other team in history. They scored 55 runs. And at the end of the ninth inning, playing against Pittsburgh, they're ahead, and Bill Mazeroski comes up to the plate with two men on base, and he wallops a home run that wins the World Series. Also, the 1964 World Series, St. Louis versus the New York Yankees in the seventh game, Ken Boyer hit a three-run homer to win it for the St. Louis Cardinals. But the most significant thing about that game is you played a theme at the opening of this segment that people don't know what it was, but I stood up. It's the seventh inning stretch theme when the organization played. So I recognized it. Well, listen to what happened in the seventh game of the 1964.
Oh, there you go again. The seventh inning stretch.
Yeah, the seventh inning stretch and the seventh game. But listen to what happened. During the seventh inning stretch, everybody stands up. And what do they announce? They announce that Nikita Khrushchev had been deposed.
Oh, my. That was 64, I think.
64, yeah. 1964 World Series. I'll never forget that. What? Khrushchev deposed?
Yep.
And we were all wondering if he was going to be killed, but he wasn't. They just sent him off to
a rocking chair on his DACA because I think in retrospect, the reason Kennedy was murdered and the reason that they exiled Khrushchev is because they both agreed to go to the moon together, and that was not to be allowed because of what's waiting for us on the moon, and we would have done it the right way. And both these leaders who overcame their backgrounds, their proclivities, their conservatism, their hatred for the other, they both decided, and then a few days later, Kennedy's murdered.
Yeah, but let me say we have a couple of minutes. I just want to mention one name. Dmitry Arkhipov. Dmitry Arkhipov, Nikita Khrushchev, and John F. Kennedy saved the world from nuclear holocaust. Dmitry Arkhipov was a naval officer on the submarine B-59, and they had a nuclear torpedo. They had been told if the Americans do this or this, it's war. And the United States started depth charging them. And these guys thought that the World War III had broken out.
And in those days, it wasn't a national command. Like, you didn't go back to the Kremlin or to Khrushchev. It was a local commander who could decide right. to use nukes or not.
That's right. And they had given them orders, pre-written orders, that if this, then, right?
Yep.
So the captain and the political officer, every Soviet command had the commanding officers and the executive officer, and they always had this ideologue, the guy who was enforcing the Marxist ideology. And if they deviated from Marxist ideology, they would be reported and they'd be executed. So the captain and the political ideologue said, yes, we have to launch the nuclear missile. And they, like we do, they had to have three keys or the consent of three men. And Dmitry Arkhipov said, no.
Okay, we are coming up to a hard break, top of the hour. I'll say we'll pick this up on the other side.
Okay.
You're on the other side of midnight. My guest this morning, Robert Morningstar, Andrew Curry, Ron Gerbron. Keith is hovering in the background. And this is the longest organist in Major League Baseball, Gary Pressey, to take us out.
Buddy, we are here.
We shall return.
Wrigley Field, home of the Chicago Cubs. And we are here with an absolute legend of Wrigley Field, Gary Pressey. Gary, thank you so much for being here, or allowing us to be here.
great to do it for you guys. You guys are super.
You're the organist here?
Yes, I am.
And how long have you been the organist?
This is my 33rd year. 1987
years.
When we started.
Wow.
I've done over 2,623 consecutive games.
Whoa.
Yeah.
So you've never missed a game?
Haven't missed one yet.
So, like, when I was here in the 90s, that was you when I was here at the game.
Yes, it was.
Any Cubs game. That's you.
That was me.
Wow. How did you end up?
TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com. Talk radio with pictures on demand. Liberate your hyperdimensional time scale and non-linearly access over 400 hours of conversation at the cutting edge of science and thought. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive content that fits your interests and time schedule. Filter episodes by guest or subject. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Talk radio with pictures on demand. TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com.
So he would be warming up before the game, and I would go into. He would look up and wait. So that was pretty cool. Jody Davis, the catcher. He would.
And welcome back on Major League Baseball Talk on this Saturday night, now Sunday morning, here on the other side of midnight. My guests are Andrew Curry and Robert Morningstar. I believe Ron Gerbron is back with us. And I'm going to go to Ron in a minute. But, Andrew, you had something you wanted to add about Doubleday.
Yeah, it's I found this article from NPR.org, and this is back from March of 2011. And the title is The Secret History of Baseball's Earliest Days. And I'm just going to read a small part of this because this is a little excerpt about an author who wrote a book called Baseball in the Garden of Eden. The Secret History of the Early Game. And it's just, let me read it. It's very curious. So this is about deciding who discovered, quote-unquote, baseball. To settle the matter, the two men appointed a commission headed by Abraham Mills, the fourth president of the National League of Professional Baseball Clubs. The commission, which also included six other sports executives, labored for 3 years, after which it declared that Abner Doubleday invented the national pastime. This would have been a surprise to Doubleday. The late Civil War hero never knew that he had invented baseball. But 15 years after his death, he was anointed as the father of the game, says John Thorne.
Thorne, the official historian of Major League Baseball, has just written, remember this is 2011, 11 years ago, Baseball in the Garden of Eden, The Secret History of the Early Game, about the sport's earliest days. He says the myth about Doubleday inventing the game of baseball actually came from a Colorado mining engineer. He claimed he had been present at a schoolboy game at which Abner Doubleday took a stick and drew in the dust the diagram for a complete new ball game, says Thorne. In fact, the ball game that this
Your
Colorado...
recording has reached the maximum length. To replay your message, press 1. To delete and re-record your message, press...
I will, dear. I will. In fact, the ball game that this Colorado mining engineer describes was very similar to the game that had been played in many localities for probably 100 years. So why would the Colorado mining engineering person make up the Doubleday myth? It is a great question, says Thorne. What brought a mining engineer to Akron, Ohio, where he typed out his letter to Spalding's secretary? Last I heard, there's not much metallurgy opportunity in Akron. And then he went back west and continued to correspond with the Cooperstown newspaper, embellishing his tale to say that he played in the game with Doubleday and that it was a rollicking game. And then it just goes on to talk about the various versions of baseball that were, you know, in early United States. So there's just a lot of shrouded mystery. Now, what's interesting about Doubleday is that he did become a prominent member of the Theosophical Society. So after he retired, right, from his duties and stuff. And so he would have been highly aware of, like, occult symbology, sacred geometry, and numerology. So there's a lot going on here, guys. It's almost like the Council of Nicaea deciding how Christianity was going to be, you know, fleshed out going forward. It's very, very strange. And it's not as innocent. It's a lot more design than I think we know. And like you said, Richard, we're seeing that in the numbers that are these sort of magical numbers that are associated with the game. I mean, 108 is considered unity and wholeness, right? The Fibonacci sequence has 108 embedded in its equation. And, you know, and apparently it wasn't Leonardo Fibonacci that came up with it. This comes from the Sanskrit texts that used Hindu Arabic numeral systems. So this is really ancient. These numbers, number of stitching on a baseball, is incredibly ancient. And, you know, when Ron was talking about these Mayan games, which, by the way, looks an awful lot like Quidditch as well from the Harry Potter series, mm-hmm. with the circles. Yeah, it's very interesting. You got to wonder where codified ritualistic games, quote unquote, come from originally. You know, I mean, are we talking really ancient history here? And the fact that they were used as games to decide political and, what was it, Ron, wars, the conclusion of wars is, you know, is amazing.
Yeah, yeah. Ron unfortunately dropped. So
let me say this for Ron. There is a very twisted ending to those games that the Aztecs played when they played that game of putting the rubber ball through.
No,
the
it wasn't
hoop.
The Aztec. It was the Mayans.
The Mayans.
And Ron Ooh. Believes it came actually. He found origins in the Olmecs, which was the precedent. Classical middle.
Well, the Aztecs played it too, and when the Aztec team lost, they died.
or at least some of them died. I wanted him to get into the whole history of that and why it apparently had real interesting cosmic significance, going back to the theme of tonight, which is we've got two teams playing. One represents the founding fathers, the other represents the future of humanity in the solar system, spearheaded by the Astros, which were named specifically after NASA, the Houston Astrodome, and going to the moon, where in a couple of weeks we're going to try to do it again.
Yeah. Well, you know, going back to baseball, I'd like to – I mentioned Whitey Ford, so I'd like to mention a couple of things. Whitey Ford was born in Manhattan, so he was a born and bred Yankee, New York Yankee from the cradle. And he served in Korea for 2 years, so he served in the U.S. Army honorably, came out, and in the course of his career, he was 10 times an All-Star, six times World Series champion, Cy Young Award winner in 1961, World Series MVP in 1961, three times American League wins leader, twice Major League Baseball ERA leader and run average. His number was retired, and there's a monument to him out in the middle of Yankee Stadium, along with Michael Ruth and Gehrig and the others. So he's very memorable, a very, very beautiful, beautiful pitcher, graceful, sneaky. He had a slider that just like could, you know, people would walk away and break their bats. So he just frustrated. He was really slick. He had the psychology, you know, of baseball, and he could vary his pitches. He had a good fastball. He wasn't at Sandy Koufax at 100 miles an hour. But that and his changeup, his slider, and his curveball really make him one of the greatest baseball players.
Back on the subject of records, remember I asked you before to list the Major League Baseball records that are now tabulated. In that early kind of overview of Babe Ruth's career, the announcer, obviously from a script, was tabulating the distance of his various home runs.
Right.
And I don't know anybody these days who's doing that. It's just if you make it to the seats or you make it out of the park, that's considered a home run. But when did they drop the idea that the distance was part of the record?
Well, that came up with Mickey Mantle, but he said that Babe Ruth hit a ball 585 feet. Mickey Mantle hit 565. He hit several that were 600 feet. He hit a 653-foot home run in Arizona. But Babe Ruth was hitting a dead ball. And
what do you mean? What do you mean? Define
the baseball was different in the days of Babe Ruth. It wasn't as sturdy. It didn't have the cork center and as much winding. So it was hitting like a softer ball.
So it was just wrapped horsehide.
Yeah, it was wrapped inside, but it didn't have the high tech design and composition that the modern baseball has. So the modern baseball would travel probably, I would say, 20% farther than the Babe Ruth baseball. So he hit, it was to be like hitting a hacky sack. That's my closest example, you know, exaggerated example. So Babe Ruth was really super powerful. The other thing about Babe Ruth, if you notice, he didn't take long strides. He took very rapid, small steps, which preserves your frame and saves your legs. He lasted a long time. But that's one thing I teach people. You know, you can run fast if you take long strides, but you can run just as fast if you take short strides but increase the frequency.
Yep.
That'll save wear and tear on your joints, and that's why I'm still out there running it.
As my local mice prove every single night when I'm go upstairs and they all run like hell. Hey, I've got racked up here this as classic thing from George Carlin, which Andrew supplied us with, defining from the stage the difference between the national pastime, baseball, and football. And Carlin is always cool to listen to anytime, any season, any time of day or night. So let's listen to George Carlin define why we're obsessed with baseball.
I'd like to do something called baseball and football. And it's, thank you. That's nice. Because these two things are such a part of our lives, these two activities, and yet they're so different. Baseball is pastoral, 19th century. Football is technological, 20th century. Baseball is played on a diamond in a park, the baseball park. Football is played on a gridiron in a stadium, War Memorial Stadium. In baseball, you wear a cap. In football, you wear a helmet. Baseball has a seventh inning stretch. Football has a 2-minute warning. Baseball has no time limit. We don't know how long it's going to last. We might have extra innings.
Football is rigidly timed, and it will end even if we have to go to sudden death. Football is based on downs. What down is it? Baseball is based on ups. Who's up? Are you up? I'm not up. In football, you get a penalty. In baseball, you make an error. Whoops. In baseball, in the stands, there's something of a picnic feeling. You know, emotions may run high, but there's not that much unpleasantness. In football, in the stands, you can be sure that at least 27 times during the game, you were capable of taking the life of a fellow human being. Preferably a stranger. To sum this up, the objects of the game is quite different. The object of the game in football is for the quarterback, otherwise known as the field general, to be on target with his aerial assault, riddling the defense by hitting his receivers with deadly accuracy in spite of the blitz, even if he has to use the shotgun. With short bullet passes and long bombs, he marches his troops into enemy territory, balancing this aerial assault with a sustained ground attack which punches holes in the forward wall of the enemy's defensive line. In baseball, the object is to go home. I'm going home. Well, I don't have an ending for that, but that'll do until one comes along. You know what I mean? Yay. This weekend, sports fans won't want to miss Universe of Sports.
Oh, that's pretty cool. George Carlin, where did he get anything wrong? I didn't see anything wrong there. Did you?
No, that was great.
So, Andrew, I want to, because we're, is Ron back with us?
Yes, I am. But, yeah, it's, my phone, as you realize, is in hospice care. So I'm.
Sounds really good.
It sounds much better than before. You know, bouncing it off that satellite over Tokyo really is helping.
Yeah, I know. I'll have to talk to Elon Musk about that. Anyway, I'm here. Whatever you've been doing, remember, I can't hear you if the phone can't connect.
We were basically filling until we got you back, because I wanted to ask you, in terms of tracing the history of baseball back through time, how does it connect? And I want you to be kind of specific about this connection to the Mayan Aztec ball game, which you say doesn't have a name, but the names we've got, they must have translations. What do the translations say about this Mayan game?
Nothing very informative. The short, simple word pits, I couldn't find a translation for that. And so the assumption was that it was probably a swear word or something. Didn't matter. Remember, the game has very humble beginnings. It was not designed, apparently, for a ritual, but it became one. So I can remember one of the translations. Everybody's heard of the Olmec. Well, there was a group of people that were the responsible purveyors of most of the rubber to everybody else. And everybody called them the Olmeca. And although it's not exactly the same as, you know, you can't just say the Olmec part means something, but that Olmeca means rubber people. So the names weren't very important, but the rubber was. So I wanted to have a bunch of hard to pronounce Mesoamerican names, but when you can't be sure who is responsible for which part of it, it kind of clouds it. But Olmec is the culture that we know very little about that preceded all the other ones. And if you've ever seen one of those large
The Olmecs are the guys that have all these bizarre statues all over Central America that have all these multi-ethnic, multi-racial, multicultural faces that look like they were assembling a team from all over the world.
Yes.
Well,
they did seem to have connections. Yeah, well, wait a second. There's a the this ties into the game, and it turns out that there's a misconception people have when they think that any of those heads, and you know me, I'm a spaceship kind of guy, but the I'm trying to get used to using the phone differently here. The when they look like they've got a spacesuit on, and I am excluding the famous Palenque astronaut and a couple of similar things I found on Mars. But in the general case of the statues Richard was just talking about, that the costume that they wear, you'll notice, usually has a helmet, not unlike an old-fashioned original issue leather-type football helmet from the, 1910.
The Newt Rockne era.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not sure what year that was. But they look, they don't look unlike that. Those are, even though those were kings and even demigods portrayed in the statues, they were, it was like a politician putting on a hard hat when they went to a construction site to give a speech. They wanted everyone to know that the game was part of their persona. I mean, it comes perilously close to the Hunger Games when you
So the game was not an ancillary, it was foundational to something about their civilization.
Perfect. Yes, exactly. The game itself stretches back into the mists of time, and there were undoubtedly and unquestionably hundreds of variations. The basic fundamentals are interesting, but we don't know what the rules were by which they played. But the version of it that they had in the original series of Battlestar Galactica as their recreational thing was no more inaccurate than any of the professional scholarly journal articles that I've read about it. They don't know what they're talking about, most of them. They're trying to fit it into some model. And it was just simply a ball game that everybody liked. And the oldest tangible depictions of it anywhere we have are from around 1700 BC. And half of the people in the, it's a collection of statues and figurines, and half of them are holding sticks. So the connection between a stick and a ball goes back to there, because the rubber ball was just without question. In fact, when you look at even up through the Mayan art in their sculptures, they really like circles. They've got all these, those are balls. Those are the balls from the game. They're everywhere in everything. There's one of the pictures that I sent in tonight. It says Uxmal, which is a Mayan site in not even Olmec or anything, in Mexico. And although that's not one of the target rings for the game, I don't think, it's about the same scale. And you'll notice the round balls running through it. So I'm thinking it might have had something to do with it, because this is just the shorthand, because no point in wasting a lot of time on it unless we were delving into their mythology. But just to get the technical stuff out of the way, and then the mythology is easier.
Hey, Ron, I actually own two of those statues, rather large ones, that were dug up in an island in Lake Managua. And they actually do look like Anunnaki. The larger one is about 2.5 feet tall, made of red clay pottery. It has a huge hook nose like the Anunnaki, and has kind of...
Wait. You keep saying, have you met any Anunnaki?
I've seen the Anunnaki sculptures, from Sumeria, right?
Oh, you guys, Ron fell off there. So, Robert, he didn't hear you, at least.
Oh, well, it's too bad, because that was building up.
Anyway. We'll get him back. He's working overtime tonight to get him back. Hey, I've got something I want to play here while we're waiting to get Ron back. Tom Hanks, who's America's modern Jimmy Stewart, had a brilliant soliloquy in A League of Their Own called There's No Crying in Baseball. So let's take a listen. Okay, this is really amazing.
Hey, Evelyn, can I ask you a question? You got a moment?
As I was saying.
Which team do you play for?
Well, I'm a peach.
Well, I was just wondering,
because I couldn't figure out why you would throw home when we've got a two-run lead. You let the tying run get on second, and we lost the lead because of you. Now you start using your head. That's not love. That's 3 feet above your ass.
Are you crying?
No.
Are you crying? Are you crying? There's no crying. There's no crying in baseball.
Why don't you leave her alone, Jimmy?
Oh, you zip it, Doris. Rogers Hornsby was my manager, and he called me a talking pile of pig shit. And that was when my parents drove all the way down from Michigan to see me play the game. And did I cry?
No.
No. No. And you know why?
No.
Because there's no crying in baseball. There's no crying in baseball. No crying.
What's the matter, Jimmy?
What? She's crying, sir.
I didn't mean to do that.
Perhaps you chastise her too vehemently. Good rule of thumb. Treat each of these girls as you would treat your mother.
You ever tell you look like a penis with a little hat on?
You're out of here!
Oh, no,
right
no,
now,
no,
Jimmy,
you,
I heard
you
that.
You misunderstood.
You misunderstood me.
No,
you can't throw me out for that.
Jimmy.
No, you've got to stop.
Right now.
Stop. 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 Stop.
Stop.
We are back. That's one of those classics, you know. There's a million of them. You know, we've enshrined baseball at such a level in multicultural, you know, there's art, there's radio. You know, remember Ronald Reagan recreated whole games out of nothing when the line went dead. There's movies, there's, you know, songs. We'll have some more songs at the end of this segment. But, Ron, let's go back to the origins, because it seems to me, looking at the Mayan, Aztec, Olmec litany, that balls represented cosmic stuff like planets, celestial objects, and the idea at some archetypal level was moving celestial bodies around symbolically.
You're not completely off the mark there, I don't think. That's why... the pictures that I sent in, one of them at the top is the oldest, probably.
Okay, let's go to Ron's
the oldest
section of radio pictures. Yeah. Ball game combination. Click on that. Oh, that's weird. What's that little circle sticking out like a old? What was that little candy with a hole in the middle?
Lifesavers.
Sticking out from a...
Very good. That's exactly what they look like.
They look like lifesavers stuck outside a wall.
That's the goal. That's what you put the ball through.
That's tiny. That's really tiny.
Did I post the... I had a lot of trouble finding measurements for them because as the Spanish recorded, they made them in all different sizes. And you'll notice there's one color, like snapshot type photograph in that grouping, and it shows a couple of guys, you know, banging around it with the ball in the air.
Yeah, it's in the bottom right hand corner.
Well, it's at the top particular combo. I don't know. I can't remember which number it is. Yeah.
When you click on it, it's in the bottom right hand corner of the enlargement of number one.
But he's talking about the live people on the top there.
Exactly. The live people. That's what the ball looks like.
Oh,
but they can be the size of a softball or the size of a, what do you call the small soccer ball?
I'm not sure.
Small soccer?
Maybe a
volleyball?
Small soccer ball. Yeah.
Beach ball?
Yeah, volleyball. Well, maybe volleyball. Tiny bits.
It looks like it's about 10 to 12 inches.
But there was no standardization, none to it. I mean, if people play it these days, I mean, I assume their balls are all going to be about the same size.
I'm going to pass on that.
Yeah,
I really like the color on the guy on the left. It looks very Egyptian.
Yeah. Now, you notice their outfits. They've got like a pad, like a shin guard on their forearm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because the one guy's holding it up. That's why I put the live picture in there. It's just a tourist photo from Chiapas or someplace in Mexico where they were doing a demo, an exhibition. They're wearing like what looks like strangely heavy clothing. The collar, that wide ring collar that they wear, is actually armor. You know, you were talking about people getting killed by baseballs. These balls can be very, very hard, as well as not quite so hard. So they can, yeah, people have died just from being hit by the ball, because what they can't touch it with their hands. They have to whack it either with their sometimes it's a forearm, sometimes it's literally the elbow. The armor looks like the stuff that a hockey goalie wears without the clothing underneath it.
I'll tell you what, we're at the bottom of the hour. We'll pick this up when we come back on the other side. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We're doing Major League Baseball tonight in honor of the fact that we are in the second game tonight. The Astros won between the Houston Astros and the Philadelphia Phillies. Third game is Monday night, and that's also when there's a very important date in the Congress that I will briefly talk about when we return. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. Don't touch that dial, because we're coming up on a seventh inning stretch.
The Other Side of Midnight.com. Talk radio with pictures on demand. Liberate your hyperdimensional time scale and non-linearly access over 400 hours of conversation at the cutting edge of science and thought. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive content that fits your interests and time schedule. Filter episodes by guest or subject. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Talk radio with pictures on demand. The Other Side of Midnight.com.
Will you stand still? Pick up your hat. Go pick up your hat. Now look. Then you'll go and peddle your popcorn and don't interrupt the act anymore?
Yes, sir.
All right. But you know, strange may seem, they give ball players nowadays very peculiar names.
Funny
names? Nicknames, pet names.
Not as funny as my name, Sebastian Dinwiddie.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Funnier than that?
Oh, absolutely. Really? Yes. Now, on the St. Louis team, we have who's on first, what's on second. I don't know who's on third.
That's what I want to find out. I want you to tell me the names of the fellows on the St. Louis team.
I'm telling you, who's on first, what's on second. I don't know who's on third.
You know the fellows' names?
Yes.
Well, then who's playing first?
Yes.
I mean, the fellow's name on first base.
Who?
The fellow playing first base for St. Louis.
Who?
The guy on first base.
Who is on first?
Well, what are you asking me for?
I'm not asking you. I'm telling you. Who is on first?
And welcome back, everyone. I tell you, that never gets old. It may be that I saw it when I was, you know, young enough that it kind of like on a gosling, you know, the first creature that a bird sees when it comes out of the egg becomes mama. That Lou Abbott and Costello routine just amazing. Anyway, I think, Ron, you had the floor.
I was describing the luxurious costumes of the players in that game. It's that's all those pictures were meant for, is perspective, so people knew what this stuff looked like. It's hard to visualize it otherwise. Anyway, they wear kind of a skirt. I'd call it a skirt or a kilt.
I would say a kilt, probably, yes.
Yeah, but kilts, I mean, in any case, it's reinforced and padded a little more than it looks like, because the one thing that you could do, which was apparently the way that you passed the ball, was
oh no,
you could was to bump it with your hip. Bump it with your hip.
Okay.
Yeah, in fact, you asked me about the translating some of those words. That just reminded me of one that you wouldn't like my pronunciation of it anyway, but it's a description of the game, colloquially amongst the Maya, and it translates to a game of bottoms. So yeah, they were bumping.
Well, sounds like soccer, where you use all your hand parts, including your body, to get the damn ball over the in basically into the net past the goalie.
Yeah, except this is the opposite of that, because you can't touch it with your hands, but you cannot let it touch the ground. So the whole game is involved with them smashing into each other as they're trying to get into a position to give it a bump or a block, I guess you'd call it, with whatever's on their arm to move it along, but they can't use their hands, and they certainly can't kick it.
Now, you and I were discussing, and I want to go to Andrew, because Andrew's got an input from a listener who apparently has something that he wanted to contribute, which we definitely invite here. You and I were talking the other day about modern iterations that you can go to Google and look up of this ancient Mayan game going back past the Olmecs, and it shows up in modern iterations in very interesting connections, given the cosmic overtones of tonight's discussion.
And that was me? Okay.
That was you.
Yeah, yes, you're right. You're right. Yeah, it's pelotes, not pelotes like the exercise things, but pelote like ball. Pelotes is there's like three variants of it that I saw, but it's a modern version of it, and that's probably what the picture that I included on the page is showing them doing. But you know, it has the same things. You bump and nudge the ball around.
Well, I was thinking of something even farther out, because we were talking about, I'll give you another hint, Glenn Larson.
Okay. Okay. Yes. Okay. Well, one thing. You can pick it up if it's on the ground, you know, and then put it back in the air. Like I said, the specifics and the details are lacking. And yes, I'm going to talk about Battlestar right after this. You probably have to use your hand to throw it through the little hoop.
I would think,
but not every
yeah.
place, right? But in some cases, there are fields for it, courts set up. And they don't have those. Sometimes they have markings on the ground indicating there was some sort of a goal spot involved. But the big answer that eluded all of these brilliant scholars in archaeology for many years, they said, why isn't there one at all the courts? There's, well, by current counts, about 410 of those that are recognized, those courts scattered around Mesoamerica. They weren't all made of stone. A lot of them were made of wood or possibly woven reeds or something like that. And a heck of a meteorite just went overhead. So they're reportable. They could, you know, they could take them around and set it up. So the court may have even been multi-usage. But that's why there isn't one of those rings everywhere. And it's why the sizes vary. So I don't know. There was probably significance to that. I know they had a sort of a battle-hardened version of it where they used a really hard ball. And in some cases, there's documentation in stone of this. They actually used stone balls. That seems more like something to do with the judicial system. Like I said, it was in there in between government and people. And yet there are some cities where there are none. And you go of the ancient cities and you go, well, why is that? Well, it turns out it was a convention. If you had one of those courts, it had been accepted over the generations as a way to settle disputes. Your team would go against our team, and the winner would win the point.
So it was a stylized, as opposed to war, way of settling conflict.
Right, right. They did not literally cut each other to pieces.
in these things. I mean, it's very brutal because you're banging into each other constantly trying to get control of the ball since you can't grab for it. So it's probably, you know, it's kind of like mixed martial arts mixed with hacky sack. I mean, this is a strange game. But there were lots of variations. And there were probably even some where you might have kicked it. But remember, the Mayans didn't, as a culture, wear shoes very much. So they maybe throw it. You know, maybe they had a rugby version. We don't know. But the rubber ball thing was meant that it kept it in the air.
See, what I find weird, Ron, is that, you know, and you did some pretty deep dives into this. For however long the mystery has lasted and the importance at a cultural level of this game, it's weird that we don't know its origins or its significance or its cosmic connection other than these kind of vague hints that it was very pervasive, and there's over 400 of the ball courts that now have been found only because they're in stone and they lasted, but we don't know really very much more. That's bizarre.
Yeah, I know. Oh, and there are plenty more than that. It was, like I said, the game was ubiquitous. There was or endemic or they weren't all stone. That was just the nice ones. And so if you saw a town or a city state, more likely that had the stone courts, that was indeed this way of settling disputes. I mean, it was used for financial disputes, for property arguments, and all kinds of things. And if it was something that was military in nature, somebody would end up dead. I mean, they'd take it, the head of the coach or the got another meteorite. I didn't know there was a full nut. I've seen like six of them in the last 5 minutes.
Maybe have your range.
Yeah, they're working. Well, so far they're off at the edges, but if you hear a loud sizzling, whooshing noise, then the phone will go dead. They had a political angle. Yeah, I hate having to stammer through this because I don't want to say the parts where somebody had a crazy theory and somebody else had a completely opposite crazy theory, and neither one of them ring very true. They're just stabbing in the dark. So it's but it was
See,
there.
Again,
it was
the mystery to me is how can something so pervasive be so lost to time that we don't even know the proper name or its connections to higher level realities? That's weird.
I know. Well, the game is still around in that people still play with sticks and balls and, lay out courts for them. But it was everywhere, and apparently there was a distinction. If you saw the stone courts, then you knew that town was under that sort of edict. You know, it's not like they had an overall Commonwealth constitution or something. You know, they were all the way they wanted to be wherever they were. So this was a way of settling those. It's kind of novel.
Would it be out of bounds to say that there is this distant, symbolic, higher level connection between the Mayans' fascination with their ball game and Americans and now a large part of the Western world fascination with American Major League Baseball?
There's definitely a linkage there because there's certainly a lot of political gravitas in baseball. You know, people identify the game as a thing. You know, it's an entity by itself. It's not, you know, most sports, it's not quite so personal, you know, but people take baseball very personally. And
the link is not with baseball, actually. It's actually, we play it here now. It's called basketball. You rotate that ring to the horizontal and you're shooting hoops.
You're right. And in fact, okay, one of the appearances in sci-fi of this, showing that it's a cultural meme under an undercurrent somehow. In Battlestar Galactica, it was very, very intentional. And
Glenn Larson's original in the 1970s.
Yes. Right. And they wanted to present, it was called Triad. Because there's a whole lot of triangles. That's a flat thing that looks like a pyramid, Richard.
Mm-hmm.
Just, yeah, but
They call it, and it strangely echoes the three strikes and you're out kind of thing. But so they never published the rules for it. They didn't know either. You know, the crew worked up things to do on the set, because anytime you set up a little ball cart like that, the crew and the actors and everybody are going to use it. So they all thought it was a fun thing to do. But although there are courts that small, another thing, average size of the things and the long axis.
This is
in the Mayan
era.
Yeah. Just to conflate the things together here. The a court like that, it's like 100 yards. In other words, you know, not dissimilar to a modern ball field on the smallish side.
300 feet.
There's one at La Venta that's like bigger all around, and it's like half again that big. But they could also be as small as 20 meters. Down to that small, okay, maybe it was one-on-one competition, you know, a variation that teeters close to racquetball. But it also could have just been for the ritual uses. Because, you know, the thing about a ritual is you go through the pattern of behavior. You don't actually necessarily engage in the behavior. You just say, we do this, and then we do this, and then we do this. You're like paying homage to the steps along the way. Or you can get all physical and just do all that stuff. That's different. Right?
But we don't know whether they had professional teams. There's no hieroglyph saying, you know, and I'm going to make.
Yes, there are.
There are? Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, they had, it was a champion thing. You know, that's kind of the old, remember, there didn't used to be something called a flag either. You know, there were banners, and then there were standards before that. You know, it was an evolution. But, there were identified as, you know, with locations.
And did they go from town to town and compete against other local teams in those towns?
One would come and meet. They had to. But that was the whole point. It was your representatives to defend your town. But it could be very cordial. It could be a sporting event. And people did them for, you know, non-political reasons, too.
Hmm.
You know, so that's amateur sports, as it were. We know that because there's indications of, like, impromptu courts all over the place. You know, it was everywhere. It was everywhere, and it was embedded in everything.
When I first saw Battlestar Galactica, the original, I don't know whether the remake, which was much deeper and obviously it got better. It's like, you know, when Gene created Star Trek, The Next Generation, it was better than the original, different but better. I mean, very rarely does a copy of an idea get better with time. There are classic movies that the remake is horrible. Anyway, when I first saw it on Larson's Battlestar Galactica, and I saw the hole and the ball and the, you know, Starbuck and what's his name, dunking it through, I instantly thought of the Mayan game. And you're telling me that they didn't put that in the script. It just kind of grew like Topsy because of the people on the set saying, well, how can we make this look good?
Okay. No. I meant that it was I meant that what you saw on the screen was functional. It was not four sheets of cardboard that they fold up and then brought the camera in close to shoot the guys there pretending to play a game.
So
it was
they
built an actual court.
So it's a real ball court with real holes. They put real balls through and kept scoring all that. Okay. Where else?
God knows what that that was as inscrutable as
the
original origins.
Yeah. Did we see it? I remember there was one other occasion.
Yes. And this just occurred to me while I was in the middle of all that, of looking this stuff over. Firefly?
Oh, yes, Firefly.
The Great Lost TV show? Yeah, there's a scene in there where they're in the main cargo hold area, and they're all playing this game, and it involves a ring suspended up from the ceiling, or the top, anyway, whatever that would be, down there, and they're all—it's about, you know, 8 feet above them, and they're all throwing this ball at it.
Okay.
And I thought, okay, that is kind of a variation on the, you know, they had some sort of basketball or soccer ball or something. So, you know, Robert's not wrong about that. The connection with
basketball, but it's I don't think it was derived from it either, in either right. direction. But anyway, it was in Firefly as well, and I thought, isn't that interesting? In the new version of Battlestar, one of the producers, Ronald Moore, he made a horrible mistake when he was checking over a script or something, and he transposed the name of the card game with those funny-shaped cards.
Oh, the pyramid game in Larson's.
Yeah. And so they called the ball game Pyramid and the card game Triad.
Oh.
So you
major,
will see it. Yeah, that's...
Major mistake. Okay. Andrew.
If anybody... That...
You
yes,
have something
sorry.
From one of our listeners that sounds interesting. Please read it.
Yeah, so this was in response to the 108 stitches on the baseball.
Mm-hmm.
So this comes from, let me get this right, The Truth About the Number of Stitches and Everything About Baseball from sportsfreak.com. This is from Michael. Michael, thank you very much. Why are there 108 stitches in baseball? The ball's trajectory is controlled by three physics principles, gravity, Magnus force, and air drag. Usually the baseball is thrown, well, this is more at the children's level, 50 to 70 miles per hour. They go 90 to 100 and over. According to the principles, when the ball is thrown to the batter, gravity will pull it down to earth. Magnus force will confirm how the ball will move, and air drag ensures the ball's direction. So to move the ball in the right direction, it needs sufficient air pressure, which is to ensure that the baseball is ensured by the baseball stitching. Research shows that it needs 108 double thread stitches to generate air pressure to move. That's why there are 108 stitches on a baseball. But Richard,
I don't believe it for an instant. Because you can do it with larger stitches, spacing of the stitches. The stitches are what grab the air and create a partial vacuum, so you get curve balls and sliders and drop all that kind of stuff because of the air pressure on the rotating ball. It's rotating, rotation, 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 and you could have an arbitrary number of stitches. No, 108 is obviously symbolic. Thank you, Michael,
yes.
but I do not agree.
Well,
the rotation of the ball makes it lighter. Remember the experiments with the spinning ball bearings?
Yes. Oh, that's that.
Stayed
up also.
Longer, went higher,
yep.
and so on and so forth.
Bruce
hey,
DePalma.
You guys want to hear something? Try out because we're running out of time.
Amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, the original baseball did not have the saddle-shaped cover nor the those stitches. They looked like a squash or something because they were called quadros or quadras, and they had four sections.
So when did stitching and the idea of using air pressure by means of a rotating aerodynamic sphere spinning at some speed come into play, pun intended?
Yeah, it sounds like hot air to me.
Ritually,
you'd want the exact same thing. You'd want it to be consistent, so it could kind of, yeah. But that being the reason derived from laboratory experiments, I don't buy that.
Well, guys, if I could just add a couple of things. I want to get this in quick, and I don't want to take up all the time. But if we think about even the way a ball field looks, some people say that it's very Masonic, right? It's got the compass and it's got the square. Well, it could also be, as we said, a triangular shape and a square shape to make seven. There are four bases. Oftentimes, home plate is covered in dust. That could represent earth. That makes first base water. That makes second base air. And we often call third base the hot corner because a right-handed batter will pull sometimes really hard down that left field line. The pitcher's mound could be considered the fifth element, spirit, the centering of wholeness. Number nine, another very magical number, appears many times in baseball, in multiples and in divisions. There are three strikes, there are three outs, there are nine fielding positions, there are nine innings, there are 27 outs per game, 81 home games.
Oh, good grief, you're kidding.
81 away games.
Hang on, 27 outs per game, of course. Nine, 20. Remember, the whole hyperdimensional equation is based on Schlossky's 19th century geometry, the 27 lines on the general cubic two intertwined tetrahedral surfaces. It's all there.
Yep.
Good grief. 27. I didn't think of that. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and
that might be a resonant reason why these things get picked up and
I think you're absolutely
part of
there's a through line that's got to be,
yes,
as I titled the show tonight, cosmic, and so
yes,
it's not an accident, I think, now in terms of hyperdimensional resonance, that we've got the founding of the nation and the future of the nation represented by these two teams, and next week we go back to the moon.
Good to know.
Okay, we got 3 or 4 minutes here. Who has something pithy to say?
I thought I was going to talk about my tryout with the Yankees.
Go for it. Yes.
Okay, in 1981, I remembered something about Joe DiMaggio, which was very controversial. And I decided to write a script, and I pitched it to a producer named Earl Mack, who produced The Children of Theater Street, a movie about Russian ballet and the training of the Bolshoi children there. So he went for it, and I was supposed to play Joe DiMaggio in this film.
Wow.
About Joe DiMaggio before the Marilyn Monroe marriage. So there was going to be a two-part story, Joe DiMaggio before Marilyn and Joe DiMaggio after Marilyn. And the thing was that Joe DiMaggio became very controversial around 1939 because he was a very homely guy. And when he got rich enough, he decided to have plastic surgery to fix his teeth and fix his nose and made him a much handsomer and more dignified man. But he was really severely criticized, again, by the sharks and the New York press and people, you know, thought, you know, only actresses do, you know, plastic surgery, and they thought of it as vanity. But it actually changed his life for the better. And so the story was about the 41-game hitting streak and how that and the competition with Ted Williams that year, because it was like Maris and Mantle. DiMaggio was running a 56-game hitting streak, and Ted Williams was batting 400. And so this became the basis of what I consider the first kind of a wag-the-dog story for FDR, because though that home run race, the hitting streak versus the batting title fixated America, while Roosevelt was getting ready for World War II against the Japanese. And the 1941, also in the North Atlantic, the Bismarck was being hunted after sinking the Hood. So it was stealing, keeping America distracted from the war in many ways. So I wrote it up, and I was, at the time, I was promoting Tai Chi, as I said, that Gene Kelly did that dance, sports as dance thing. And I was promoting Tai Chi as a way of improving performance of any kind of athlete, whether runner or golfer or baseball player or football player. So I was invited to a special event that was sponsored by President Kennedy's sister, Eunice Kennedy Shriver and Sergeant Shriver for the Special Olympics. And I went there, and who was there but none other than Lee McPhail at the time, president of the American League.
Mm.
So we hit it off, and I told him about the script, and he says, you know, you should try out for the Yankees. And I was taken aback. I was like, really? He said, yeah, why don't you go to Florida and try out for the Yankees? So I said, yeah.
1:30.
And so he said, call the Yankees and tell them that Lee McPhail said that they should give you a tryout. So I went down there. And then I came back, and I had another tryout in Yankee Stadium in August of 1981. And I have to tell you, I like to say I never dropped the ball in the Yankee Stadium, but I never hit a home run either. But it's a spectacular experience, a wonderful thing to run center field. And I caught everything that was coming my way. I threw a great pitch, throw to home plate. But when it came to batting, I whiffed. And for those of you who don't know what whiffing is, that's the sound a bat makes when it doesn't hit the ball. Because I went against a pitching machine. And the pitching
machine... Hey, Robert?
Yeah.
I think you hit the apex. Could I wanted to add a number for everybody. Richard will like
it.
We got like 1 minute left.
Yeah, Ron, stop interrupting.
Okay. Sorry.
Robert, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I thought you were done. I thought it was part two.
Damn it, man. Can you hold it off? Most pitching machines are like a catapult, but this was not like that. It was two spinning wheels that were spinning hundreds of miles an hour. And the guy would show you the ball over the machine, as they called it, and they just drop it. And in an instant, it was like a UFO. It disappeared, and it was in front of your eyes. So there was no way to coordinate. When a pitcher winds up, you can coordinate your swing to his wind up and the mechanics.
Hey, Robert, I promise you, next time you're on, we will take
That's
the
okay.
proper time, and we'll get into the background. Because there's all kinds of color about, you know, basically being in a major game at Yankee Stadium. And
yeah,
we got to cover that. So I want to thank my guests tonight, Robert Morningstar, Andrew Curry, and Ron Gerbron. Tomorrow night, we're going to talk about the October surprise. And guess what? It may involve UFOs. So until tomorrow night, remember, third star on the left, straight on morning, and go Phillies!